the same dog.
You heard it here first with me, Chris McCausland.
Why are you so familiar with that sound?
Wednesday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 12th of November. This is Today with Faisal Islam and Johnny Diamond.
The headlines today. The Labour MP behind plans to allow assisted dying in England and Wales says she has drawn up the best possible legislation with the strictest safeguards anywhere in the world. We'll speak to that MP, Kim Leadbeater, at 8:10 and to the Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey about his concerns about the plans. And Sir Keir Starmer is to announce new targets for reducing the UK's carbon emissions at the COP29 climate conference.
Also in today's programme...
Hey, tell you what, football's back. Any good? Have I got the job?
That was Gary Lineker's first ever match of the day back in 1999. We'll ask what's next for sport at the BBC. Now he is standing down. And...
I turned to my partner and I said, where's the bike gone? They told me they were going to look into CCTV and they did that and apparently they found nothing.
With fewer than 3% of bike thefts leading to criminal charges, we'll talk to the cyclists taking things into their own hands. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
MPs are getting just under 3 weeks to review details of a bill that could legalise assisted dying for terminally ill adults in England and Wales. Those eligible would need to have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. Any case would involve approval from two doctors and the High Court. The House of Commons will debate the bill on Friday, the 29th of November. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
Supporters of the assisted dying bill say it would give the terminally ill control over the timing and manner of their death. The current law, they argue, condemns many people to a painful and undignified end. But opponents say any change in the law would place pressure on vulnerable people to end their lives for fear of being a financial or emotional burden. They argue resources should be focused on improving palliative care. Under the bill, those opting for an assisted death would need to take the lethal medication themselves, unlike in some other countries where doctors can administer the dose. A similar private members' bill has been brought forward in Scotland, while legislation to allow assisted dying has nearly passed all its stages in the Isle of Man.
The Prime Minister is to set out a new target for reducing the UK's fossil fuel emissions during a visit to the COP29 climate conference in Azerbaijan. Sir Keir Starmer arrived at the event in Baku last night and has said he wants Britain to become a global leader in renewables. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, is travelling with him.
This year's summit will hear calls for an increase in the amount of funding available to poorer countries to help them cope with climate change. On the flight to Azerbaijan, Sir Keir Starmer told me that didn't mean the UK would agree to stump up more public money beyond what it had already pledged. He said this summit was about agreeing financial targets rather than individual countries setting out extra contributions. The Prime Minister said the private sector had to play its part. He unveiled plans for government funding to encourage private investment in clean energy in the UK. There are nerves in Baku about the prospect of an incoming President Trump once again pulling the US out of international climate agreements. Sir Keir wouldn't comment on Donald Trump's views on climate change, but said he was very clear in his mind it was a challenge to which he must rise.
The Court of Session in Edinburgh is due to hear a legal challenge against the Rosebank and Jackdaw offshore oil and gas fields. Campaigners will argue the effect of the emissions from burning the oil and gas was ignored when both sites were approved. The UK government will not be challenging the judicial review. The Florida Senator Marco Rubio is reportedly set to be nominated by Donald Trump to be the next US Secretary of State. If confirmed, he would be the first Latino to be America's most senior diplomat. One of Mr. Trump's early political allies, Lee Zeldin, has been named as the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. The BBC is expected to make an official announcement later today, confirming the departure of one of its highest-paid presenters, Gary Lineker, from Match of the Day. He's set to leave the programme at the end of the Premier League season next May. It's understood his final job for the BBC will be presenting coverage of the 2026 World Cup. More from our culture editor, Katie Razzle.
Gary Lineker is leaving the BBC.
But the former England striker turned presenter will go out on a high, fronting the biggest football tournament in the world. Neither the BBC nor Gary Lineker has commented on the Sun's report, but I understand the presenter was open to staying on at Match of the Day. After more than a quarter of a century at the helm, the BBC didn't offer him a new contract for the show. The corporation has a new head of sport, and with Lineker's current contract coming to an end, a different agreement has been reached. Some may be happy to see the back of a man paid more than £1.3 million a year by the BBC. Others will recognise the risks of losing him. Replacing a famous presenter on a high-profile show is a high-stakes game.
An improved anti-smoking pill is to be made available on the NHS in England. The drug is a new version of one that was withdrawn 3 years ago. Here's our health correspondent, Dominic Hughes.
The number of smokers has declined sharply in the UK in recent years, but roughly one in eight adults, or around 6 million people, still smoke. More than 400,000 hospital admissions in England were linked to smoking last year, and the NHS spends around £2.5 billion annually treating health issues caused by the habit. So health experts welcomed this improved therapy to help people give up. The latest version of the drug, varenicline, works by reducing cravings for nicotine and blocking its effect on the brain. It also helps with the symptoms of withdrawal, including irritability and problems sleeping. Combined with support, such as counselling, it's been shown to help around one in four people stop smoking for at least 6 months.
The charity Cycling UK says there's a growing trend of people attempting to trace their stolen bikes despite police warnings about the risk of confronting thieves. BBC analysis of police figures for England and Wales suggests that fewer than 3% of reported bike thefts since 2019 have resulted in a charge or summons. Francesca Osborne reports.
Cyclists have told the BBC that they've resorted to dangerous methods to find and get back their stolen bikes, but claim it's their only hope of retrieving them. One man from Bristol who used a GPS tracker hidden in the bike frame said he was threatened when he tried to reclaim it. Others explain how they've scoured social media marketplaces and confronted the online sellers. Police forces advise people against taking action themselves, as it may put them at risk and be detrimental to investigations. The National Police Chiefs Council says it understands victims' disappointment and is working hard to improve the experience of those affected.
Francesca Osborne reporting.
Thanks, Caroline. Now, for the weather forecast, let's go over to Sarah Keith-Lucas at the BBC Weather Centre.
Thank you, Faisal. Good morning. The dry, settled theme to the weather continues today and for the next few days too. We've still got high pressure dominating our weather. So lots of dry weather, but not quite everywhere. We've got a bit more of a northeasterly breeze in the southeast of England, bringing a few showers. So we'll start with the detail for southeast England and East Anglia too, because that breeze coming in off the North Sea will bring a few showers today. It'll feel a little cool with gusts of wind, especially close to the south coast, up to about 30 miles an hour. But there'll be some sunshine and the showers will be very well scattered. So 10 to 12 degrees, not too bad at all. Through south-west England, South Wales, the Midlands, Lincolnshire, north-east England, eastern Scotland and northern Scotland, a dry day ahead, any early morning mist soon clearing away, light winds here generally and temperatures around 11 or 12 degrees. But through North Wales, north-west England, south-west Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's across this zone that we've got some dense fog patches first thing this morning, so really reducing visibility, especially so for parts of Northern Ireland. Any of the fog should slowly lift and clear, but it could linger for much of the day in a few spots. It's also quite chilly. We've got a touch of frost around first thing too. But by the afternoon in the sunshine, 10 to 12 degrees. It'll be another chilly night overnight tonight. Again, a touch of grass frost, 2 to 4 degrees. And a similar day tomorrow, some sunny spells developing and we'll lose those showers eventually from the southeast.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It is 8 minutes past six. Let's take a look at the papers. Several lead on the calls for the Archbishop of Canterbury to resign over his failure to ensure allegations against a prolific child abuser linked to the Church of England were properly investigated. The Daily Mail says Justin Welby's position looks increasingly untenable. The Sun says Sir Keir Starmer is refusing to back the Archbishop, a survivor of abuse by John Smythe, tells the Daily Express that Archbishop Welby put himself and the reputation of the church ahead of the welfare of victims. In a letter to the Times, the Anglican priest and former Conservative politician Jonathan Aitken says the Archbishop is right to resist calls to resign. He says those attacking Justin Welby should heed Christ's teaching, whoever is without sin, let him cast the first stone.
The Guardian's front page focuses on the publication of the assisted dying bill. The paper says it sets out hardline safeguards, including lengthy prison sentences for people who coerce terminally ill people into ending their own lives. The Daily Telegraph says people could kill themselves in just 3 weeks under the process outlined in the proposals. The broadcaster and assisted dying campaigner, Dame Esther Ranson, tells The Express she has her fingers firmly crossed that the legislation passes.
Gary Lineker quitting Match of the Day also makes the front pages. The Daily Mirror quotes an insider who says the deal has been agreed by both sides and everyone is happy. In its commentary, the Mail says the presenter has become a lightning rod and challenging employee for the BBC in deeply divided times. The Sun's headline is simply, "What a finish by Lineker." The paper says fellow pundits Mark Chapman, Alex Scott and Gabby Logan are among the favourites to succeed Mr. Lineker.
The Financial Times says the European Union is changing its spending rules to redirect potentially tens of billions of euros to defence and security. The paper says Donald Trump's return to the White House has increased pressure on the bloc to increase investment. The article says that, according to EU officials, member states will have more flexibility to spend money from Brussels on supporting the defence industry and military mobility projects.
Many of the papers reflect plans by NHS England to prescribe pills to help smokers kick the habit. The Eye quotes the Health Services Chief Executive Amanda Pritchard as saying the drug will be a game changer. The Times says a study by University College London suggested the plan would prevent 9,500 smoking-related deaths.
And The Guardian says the magic circle is trying to find a woman who defied its male-only policy in the early 90s by masquerading as a man. Sophie Lloyd had waited until the society began admitting women in 1991 to reveal her true identity. The paper says she was subsequently expelled by members angry at her deliberate deception. Now more than 30 years on, the Magic Circle is trying to track her down to apologise. Its first female chair, Laura London, tells the paper it's almost as if they just made her vanish from thin air. We'll have more on that story later in the programme. If you do appear safe, we do get in touch.
It is 11 minutes past six. Well, the papers are full of the demands for the Archbishop of Canterbury to resign his position because of what he knew and what he didn't do about a serial abuser of children and young men, John Smythe. We'll be talking later in the programme to one of those that Smythe abused and hear what he has to say about the Archbishop's position. But first, let's talk to our religion editor, Aleem Makbul. Good morning, Aleem. Can you remind us briefly of the background to this?
Yes, morning, Johnny. This was the case of John Smythe, who over 50 years, we know, abused more than 120 young men and boys, mainly at Christian summer camps in the UK in the 70s and 80s, summer camps where he would give religious instruction. He was actually a barrister. But gave religious instruction through his association with the Church of England, and then moved to Zimbabwe and South Africa, where the abuse continued. Now, for years, survivors had been waiting for a report to come out that was looking into culpability, what happened, why he was allowed to abuse for so long. That dropped last week and was damning for the Church of England, because we know now for sure that by 1982, as early as that, church officials were told. What the report says is that there was an active cover-up at that point. We also know that by 2013, those at the very top of the church, which included the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time and now Justin Welby, knew the extent of John Smythe's crimes, his behaviour. And so from that point, Justin Welby acknowledges he didn't do enough, and the abuse continued until John Smythe died in 2018.
And we heard yesterday, I think on The World at One, the Bishop of Newcastle said that she believed that the Archbishop's position was now untenable and he should step down, but there is none of that from Lambeth Palace. The Archbishop, as far as his office is concerned, is staying put.
No. The Archbishop of Canterbury, in fact, said last week when this report came out that he had thought about resigning over this issue. He was extremely sorry that the abuse had happened. He was sorry that it had taken him so long to meet survivors of John Smythe. But he had checked with those around him. He'd asked their advice and had decided not to step down. He didn't explain exactly why he felt that was the case when so many survivors and a lot of people now, certainly around him privately, think that his position is untenable. There are other bishops too who are saying things in the background, but only one has put their head above the parapet as yet.
Thank you very much. Aline McBool, our religion editor there.
The Prime Minister has arrived at the COP29 climate change summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, saying he wants the UK to win a race for global leadership on climate change. Our climate editor, Justin Rowler, joins us from Baku. Justin, what's new in the Prime Minister's plan?
Well, you could say, Faisal, the PM's strategy is leading by doing. He's going to say the Labour government is remaking the UK as a clean energy superpower. He's going to say it's in the UK's interest, but crucially also in the interest of the world. The big announcement today is going to be the country's carbon cutting commitment all the way out to 2035. He's expected to say it will be an 81% cut. That excludes aviation and shipping. Now, that is an ambitious goal, especially as the UK is off track with its promise to cut emissions by 68% by 2030. But it is in line with what the UK's climate watchdog, the Climate Change Committee, recommended. The idea is this will show commitment to the climate issue to the world. But what Sir Keir is not expected to do is promise any new cash for the rest of the world. And remember, this conference is all about finance, raising money to help developing countries transition away from fossil fuels and protect their countries from the impact of climate change. We understand he will promise to meet the previous government's target of £11.6 billion for international climate funding, something that was in doubt, but he'll go no higher. And that will be a disappointment here in Baku.
And so, Justin, we've talked about the obvious shadow of Trump's re-election over these sorts of talks. We assume he'll withdraw from the Paris Agreement, some suggesting the entire 1992 treaty as well. Are other countries stepping up?
Well, these are definitely going to be tough talks. And as you say, the shadow of Trump hangs over us all. But the list of countries whose leaders won't be attending is growing. And that obviously is a sign of commitment or lack of commitment from them. We've now got China, the US, the EU, Brazil, India, France, Germany and Canada who are not going to send leaders here. There are, however, a few newcomers. The Taliban are here for the first time. Developing countries are calling for $1 trillion a year in funding. That was going to be tough to raise at any time. But many economies are in trouble. Consumers around the world are feeling the impact of inflation. But the argument here will be, look, investing in climate action can help prevent future inflation. The UN's food price index is up more than 5% since this time last year. And a key reason for that is weather events around the world. The argument here in Baku will be that harvest-destroying weather is only going to get more frequent without bold climate action, Faisal.
Thanks so much, Justin. We'll talk to the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, just after 8:30.
It is 17 minutes past six. The proposed wind farm East Anglia 2 will, its developers hope, be capable of powering just shy of 1 million homes. Today, the project takes a step forward with the Siemens Gamesa factory in Hull securing £1 billion contract to build the turbines to power it. Will Bain has more on that and the rest of the business. Morning, Will.
Morning, Johnny. Morning, Faisal. Yeah, this comes from Scottish Power, who are developing what could be a field of 75 turbines off the Suffolk coast. And Keith Anderson, Scottish Power's chief executive, is with us. Keith, morning.
Good morning.
How significant a step is this then?
Oh, this is huge. You know, about a month ago at the investment summit, we announced we would invest £24 billion into the UK between now and 2028. And this is the first proof of it. Here's the first £1 billion contract. And what it does is it's going straight to a factory in the UK in Hull, a factory that employs 1,300 people. They've taken on an extra 600 people in the last year. And that's all on the back of contracts like this. So this shows you the investment we're promising. It shows you the investment in new renewable technology is delivering. It's delivering for the UK. It's delivering jobs. And it will deliver clean, secure, safe energy.
Timeframes now then.
So, well, this is the other important thing. It's taken us 14 years to get this project through the environmental and planning system. But it shows you how quickly we can move once we get that. Because we got a contract announced to us in September from the government. We signed the contract in October. Here we are in November, and that's us now signing contracts to build this wind farm.
Is that still the biggest challenge to you, the planning system, in terms of stepping this up to the level that Justin Rowland was kind of just talking about?
So if we want to deliver clean power by 2030, if we want to hit the net zero targets, we need to go faster and faster. And the faster we go, the faster we'll invest, the more jobs we'll create, the more manufacturing we'll create. And the really critical thing for the UK is electricity will drive economic growth. So if you go back to the budget and the whole focus on economic growth, this is what this shows you. If we invest in renewables, if we electrify the UK, we'll grow the economy, we'll create jobs, we'll create manufacturing opportunities, and we will deliver good, safe, secure, clean energy to every home in this country.
One of the factors within that pace is, of course, opposition, concerns, local worries about projects. This one, East Anglia 2 in particular, has had a lot of pretty high-profile pushback about the infrastructure that you'll need on the coastline there.
Look, yes, we go through lots of consultation. We work with local communities and local people to look at the best way of building these projects. But this country needs to build. We need to build a new economy. We need to build the infrastructure to last us for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
I suppose, is that the challenge for the government now, though, to sort of back up those words when you meet opposition? You know, celebrities, for example, are among those who have signed letters against some of the cabling that you're doing around this project or would need to do for this project when you start work there. Is it sort of money where mouth is time in terms of smoothing that planning process from your perspective?
Yes, I mean, if this country wants a growing economy, if we want to stay a world leader in AI technologies, we want data centres, we want house building, we want manufacturing, all of that needs power. We need to electrify the hell out of the UK economy to get it driving and to get it working properly and to get it growing properly. And that involves building infrastructure fit for the future.
You have got to bring people with you, though, haven't you? We've seen that very much in the United States election recently, pretty much a repudiation of a lot of this type of thing, and a very simple argument being made by the Trump campaign that energy is cheaper if there is more of a mix going back to more fossil fuels.
We need to tackle climate change. We need to drive forward with that. We need to get to net zero. That's absolutely critical. And it's critical the UK stays a world leader in doing that. But yes, we do need to take people with us, and we do. That's why we spend so much time working with local communities and local people on the best way of building these projects. And if you go to Lowestoft, which is where this site will be operated from, you'll see we've already built one huge big operation centre employing hundreds of people. And if you speak to the people in Lowestoft, they're over the moon because we've just bought a bit of land to build another operation centre to create even more jobs. And as people see the benefits of this, whether it's the benefits in our employment, the benefits from manufacturers employing people like Siemens, and the benefits in terms of economic growth, they'll understand why this is so good. And that's why it's important that contracts today show that this is real. These are real jobs, real manufacturing in the UK, and real benefits to the future of the UK.
To go at the pace you're talking about, will we not have to let China into the market, China making these turbines far cheaper than anywhere else in the world? Is that not an easy option in terms of speeding up the process, as you say?
The important thing for the UK is to make sure that we get as much of the manufacturing capacity into the UK. There's a worldwide race for building network infrastructure, cabling, for turbines, for delivering new renewable energy. And we need to make sure there's enough supply chain, enough capacity in that market to deliver all the projects we need and other countries need. The important thing is, let's get those factories in the UK, factories like this Blade factory. Then not only do we get the clean power, but we get all the jobs that go with it and all the manufacturing capacity that goes with it. And that's what will help people understand why this is so beneficial, not just for the environment, but for the future of the UK.
Keith Anderson, Chief Executive of Scottish Power, thanks so much for your time. Well, Bill Blaine is with us, founder of Windshift Capital, to look through what else is moving financial markets this morning. Bill, morning.
Morning, Will.
And we touched on the US election a little bit there. A couple of interesting things going on. Stocks of chip makers in Asian markets on the move this morning, and also the cost of US borrowing moving too.
Yeah, there's a lot of concerns in the market about where we go from here, and we won't really know until we find out more about whose Trump's choices are for the key positions in the administration. What we do know is that he's claiming he's going to do deals. And if we can get a deal on Taiwan, it's not just Ukraine we have to worry about. If we can get some kind of deal on Taiwan? Will that reopen global chip markets to China? If that happens, then you're going to see a massive demand for chips that are already in short supply. But of course, there's very few people who can build these particular chips, and the other chips just ain't so interesting to people. There is a whole market ecosystem in chips about demand and supply, and you got to have the new ones, and you got to have the smartest and brightest. So that's one of the issues there. In terms of the most important market in the world is the bond market. In bonds, there is truth. And people are looking very closely at the US Treasury market, the biggest single bond market. And they're saying, what's going to happen if, as Trump has suggested he's going to do, he's going to keep taxes low, and possibly even new tax cuts, corporate tax cuts? That means having to borrow more money. And if Trump is putting tariffs up against other nations, then their propensity to hold dollars in the form of US Treasury bonds is going to drop. And who is then going to fund the US budget deficit, which has just ballooned in recent years? And that's why people are getting nervous about the bond market.
And just explain that potential impact, or the potential knock-on for us here then as a result.
Well, the knock-on here is that if US rates go up because the US is creating global inflation by sticking on massive tariffs, we need to find alternative markets ourselves because the UK will suffer from tariffs itself. That seems to be the case. There's no particular pressing reason for the Americans to agree any special deal with the UK. But it's very likely that if we see the US dollar start to weaken because of some of the policies that Trump puts in place, all it will end up doing is exporting further inflation back into the UK and into Europe, which, of course, is already structurally weak. All these things very much in play at the moment.
Bill, another sort of fascinating spillover from last week's election has been the massive surge in the cryptocurrency markets, in particular Bitcoin, the sort of biggest and best known of them.
Yeah, it has been absolutely spectacular. I've just been looking at the price of Bitcoin. Up to $87,000 per Bitcoin this morning. Remember, this is something that had been, you know, people were saying it just wasn't going to happen. And it was down to, I think, about 17, 18,000 earlier this year. And yet it's rallied so strongly. And that's on the back of the expectation that Trump is going to deregulate crypto. He's going to open up new forms of potential innovation in crypto markets. We're talking about sacking the head of the U.S. regulator, the SEC, a guy called Gary Gensler. And that's just driven people to pile into the crypto market.
Well, someone who watches this area very closely is Emily Nicole, the cryptocurrency reporter for Bloomberg. Emily, morning.
Morning.
Is it all that bet on regulation?
At the moment, it does largely seem that way. We had institutional investors and large traders cooling off their bets on the crypto market over the last few months because with the presidential race neck and neck, you couldn't really see which way it was going to go. But since Trump's confirmation, Bitcoin's been up more than 30% since then. It went above $89,000 actually last night. So it's definitely rising a lot. And most of that we think is coming from those large traders.
Yeah. And Gary Gensler, an important figure, as Bill mentioned there, the current head of the regulator, the SEC, because he has taken the fight, I suppose, or taken his skepticism and then subsequently the fight to those crypto firms over the past few years.
It's been a tough time to be a crypto company in the US for sure. It's been a couple of years of multiple enforcement actions, a lot of companies saying that they don't really know which playground they're playing in. The SEC itself says that crypto companies should obey by traditional financial rules and that all the rules they have at the moment are fit for purpose. But with Donald Trump promising to get rid of Gensler on day one, that was definitely a major appeal to the crypto companies.
And is it about some of the personnel who may be in post as well, people in the administration?
There are several people who Trump has kind of eyeballed, or, you know, he's still making his picks, but Elon Musk being one of them. He's a pro-crypto person and has been for quite some time. He's set to be part of the Department of Governmental Efficiency, I think he calls it, as well as Howard Lutnick, who is due to oversee personnel. He is currently the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, a major fund, but that has close ties to one of crypto's largest companies in Tether.
Yeah, really interesting in that, for those personnel picks. Emily, thanks so much for your time. Emily Nicole there, the cryptocurrency reporter for Bloomberg.
Thanks, Will. From the crypto surge to the sports news, here's Mike Williams.
Faisal, thank you. Good morning. We start with more on the suspension announced yesterday of Premier League referee David Coote. The 42-year-old who took charge of his last match on Saturday evening is being investigated after a video allegedly showing him making derogatory comments about Liverpool and the club's former manager Jurgen Klopp was circulated on social media yesterday.
What did you think of the Liverpool game earlier when you were fourth official?
Liverpool.
You think of Jurgen Klopp?
Absolutely. So I did my best not to speak to him.
Well, it's not clear when the video was filmed, and it hasn't been independently verified by the BBC. Refereeing body, the PGMOL, says Coote's suspension comes into force with immediate effect and is pending a full investigation. Liverpool say they are aware of the video but are yet to comment. Rick Parry is chairman of the English Football League.
PGMOL is dealing with it. They have suspended him and they've acted quickly. And PGMOL will make sure that they deal with it thoroughly, professionally, and then it takes its course. So I think that's really all I've got to say.
And we'll have more on this in the next hour of the programme. Elsewhere, Ruud van Nistelrooy has left Manchester United ahead of the arrival of the club's new manager, Ruben Amorim. The Dutchman, van Nistelrooy, won three and drew one of the four matches that he was in temporary charge for. The former United midfielder, Darren Fletcher, is remaining part of the new coaching setup at Old Trafford. Meanwhile, eight players have withdrawn from the England squad to face Greece and the Republic of Ireland in this upcoming international break, with Aston Villa's Morgan Rogers amongst several new faces called up for the first time as replacements. Finally, as Johnny and Faisal have already touched on this morning, would be remiss if we did not mention the other big football story this morning.
BBC has had some wonderful football presenters that have hosted Match of the Day.
We begin with the most played fixture in English league history. Aston Villa versus Everton.
Des told me once, he said, "I never say joining me tonight, I always say joining us tonight."
It's been a big day at both ends of the table. The top three and the bottom six all in action. Two Premier League winners in the studio, Micah Richards and Joe Hart. Only one of them got relegated.
If you're playing in football, it's probably a dream to play in a World Cup. If you're a presenter of football, you want to present Match of the Day. So sort of to have done both is like two dreams come true, really.
Gary Lineker stepping down as Match of the Day host after 25 years. This expected to be confirmed by the BBC later today. I know we'll have more on this, much more, later in the programme. Saturday nights won't be the same again, Faisal.
It certainly won't be. And more on that later. Thanks, Mike.
On BBC iPlayer.
You is a homosexual, Barry.
I am a Barrysexual.
Based on the novel from the Booker Prize winner Bernardine Evaristo.
What happened to us, Barry?
Life happened, Carmen.
Do you know what Mum thinks the problem is?
You don't like women.
We are in this for life.
I have to tell her my truth. No more sneaking around.
Mr. Loverman.
You're about to burst into song.
I might, because I want to sing your name into the night.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
It's just a smidgen after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Faisal Islam. And now, a summary of the news with Caroline Nichols.
The details of a draft law that would legalise assisted dying in England and Wales have been published ahead of a vote in Parliament at the end of this month. The bill would allow those who are terminally ill with less than 6 months to live to self-administer medication to end their life. The Labour MP behind the proposed legislation, Kim Leadbeater, insists there are safeguards to protect those who could be coerced into killing themselves. The Prime Minister is to set out a new target for reducing the UK's fossil fuel emissions during a visit to the COP29 climate conference in Azerbaijan. Sir Keir Starmer arrived at the event in Baku last night and has said he wants Britain to become a global leader in renewables. He's expected to set a goal of reducing emissions by 81% by 2035 compared to 1990 levels. A court in Edinburgh will begin hearing a legal challenge to the approval of drilling in the UK's largest untapped oil field. The environmental groups Greenpeace and Uplift are trying to stop the development of the Rosebank field off Shetland, which was given the go-ahead last year. Their lawyers will argue that changes in the way environmental impact are measured since then mean approval should be revoked. Donald Trump is continuing to appoint politicians to senior roles in his upcoming administration. US media outlets are suggesting he'll name the Florida Senator Marco Rubio as Secretary of State. Mr. Rubio has voted against providing US military aid for the war in Ukraine and has supported Mr. Trump's America First policy, which seeks to keep the US out of foreign conflicts. The BBC is expected to make an official announcement later confirming the departure of Gary Lineker from Match of the Day. He's set to leave the programme at the end of the Premier League season next May. An improved anti-smoking pill is to be made available on the NHS in England. The drug is taken once a day and is regarded as being as good as vaping when it comes to helping people to quit.
Thanks, Caroline. It is 25 minutes to seven. The Labour MP Kim Leadbetter has published details of her bill to legalise assisted dying. It's described by the MP as having the strictest safeguards in the world. Let's talk to the BBC's chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, about the details. Good morning, Henry. It's a private member's bill, so it's up to MPs to decide. It's not going to be whipped or driven by the government. Do you get any smell about which way the Commons leans on this?
No, I don't think so. And actually, the main protagonists on either side of the debate say that the biggest chunk of MPs are still unsure. They are weighing up that balance between people's choice at the end of their lives and the risk that they might be coerced into making a certain choice at the end of their lives. I mean, speaking to MPs who are in that group, who are making up their minds, you have lots of people there who are instinctively in favour of legalising assisted dying. But the big concern I hear from them again and again is scrutiny. Because it's a private member's bill, and that is not Kim Leadbetter's decision, but it's just a quirk of the process, this bill is only being published now, 2.5 weeks before MPs will have to vote on November the 29th. So if it did clear that hurdle, there'd be a lot more scrutiny further down the track. And so some MPs believe that this process is just not the right way to do it. That's a point being made, for example, by Darren Jones, Chief Secretary to the Treasury. But the other cabinet minister whose name comes up again and again is Wes Streeting, especially among Labour MPs. The health secretary has let it be known that he is opposed to this, and that is weighing quite heavily on MPs.
And so you've got the health secretary. I mean, I think he says at the moment palliative care in the NHS is simply not good enough to be an alternative. There isn't the provision. You've also got the Prime Minister as well, who I don't think has sort of showed his hand on this. Do you think, again, his thinking will sway Labour MPs, or do you think this is largely going to be down to how individuals make up their mind on what's called a matter of conscience?
Well, Keir Starmer hasn't confirmed how he'll vote, but he has said that his views on this are pretty well known, I think is the phrase he used. Right. And by that he means he voted in favour of it in 2015. That's the last time the Commons discussed this. At that point, only 118 MPs voted in favour of legalising assisted dying. The number is definitely going to be higher this time, much higher, though it may well not end up being a majority. But absolutely, you know, over the next couple of weeks, all MPs will be discussing, I mean, I'm told they already are, discussing in the division lobbies or in quiet moments with each other how each of them are going to vote. And though cabinet ministers are not meant to be formally campaigning, in practice, I think, I mean, you've got to remember, more than half of MPs in this parliament are new to parliament. They've never been MPs before, so they are naturally looking to those more senior MPs for guidance on how they should fall on what is not just a political judgment, but a moral one as well.
Henry, thank you as always. Henry Zeffman, there, our chief political correspondent, and we'll be speaking to the MP behind the legislation, Kim Leadbetter, at 8:10.
Now, 30 days ago, the Biden administration set a deadline that expires today for Israel to improve humanitarian conditions in Gaza with a series of specific steps or to face consequences in terms of military aid. The Israelis have said that they've met most demands, but the State Department recently rated compliance as a fail, with the humanitarian situation in much of Gaza remaining dire. Our correspondent, Joe Inwood, is in Jerusalem. Joe, where is this process going today?
So what we're going to see is, this is the deadline for that 30 days since that letter, whether action happens immediately or over a period of time or not at all is a key question. For America, this is a situation they've been demanding is improved for, well, for a long period, but at least in explicitly the last 30 days, they wanted to see at least 350 trucks of aid a day getting into the Gaza Strip. Israel has said it has complied with the demands, but the data doesn't really back that up. We think around 40 trucks a day on average came in over the last month or so. And to put, give you the context, before the war started, between 500 and 600 a day were coming in. The question is, what levers can America pull and will they do it? The biggest one, and this was explicitly stated in that letter, is arms shipments. Now, America is far and away the biggest supplier of military aid to Israel. They give them billions of dollars every year. In fact, a report from Brown University said that since the 7th of October, they've given them $18 billion. That's not an official figure, that's their analysis. And so that is the biggest lever they could pull. It wouldn't be without precedent to an extent. Back in May, America decided to pause shipments of the biggest, the most destructive bombs, 2,000 and 1,000 pound bombs, because of concerns over the humanitarian situation and specifically the death toll. So they have used the lever a little bit to influence the Israeli government, but they haven't pulled it fully, as some people have been calling them to. Of course, the context here is these are the final days of the Biden administration, and so it is possible that they will think that bold action is an option now, but certainly they haven't taken that action before.
Joe Inwood in Jerusalem, thanks for that.
It is 20-7. Once he was a rival to Donald Trump, now it looks as if Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, is going to be the president-elect's pick for Secretary of State, the US's top diplomat. That's the word coming out of the New York Times this morning. It's far from an official announcement, but earlier I got a bit more detail from Tom Bateman, our correspondent in Washington.
We've now got much of the US media anticipating this, and it is described as Donald Trump's current thinking that Marco Rubio will become Secretary of State, although it should be said that this is Donald Trump, and as quite a few people are noting here, he can still change his mind right up to the last minute. But a significant announcement if it turns out to be Marco Rubio, I think largely because of where that places Trump administration foreign policy, the kind of direction it looked like it was going in, gives it much more clarity. I mean, this is a person who is traditionally actually quite hawkish on foreign policy, traditionally a neoconservative or from that wing of the party, but has tended to change his views over recent years to align more closely with Donald Trump, to bring him into this sort of hawkish isolationism, if that isn't too much of a contradiction in terms of Donald Trump, which says that it wants to end the wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East without giving much detail on how, alongside a kind of projection of American force and military power in order to deter this sort of axis of adversaries that they see, as in China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. But at the same time, as Donald Trump would put it, not going to war. So ultimately summed up by him and others and Marco Rubio is what they call peace through strength.
And Tom, if it is Marco Rubio, are we now getting a sense of the kind of administration that Donald Trump will form? Or is it actually still somewhat early days for that, given that we're some way off from the inauguration and the beginning of this actual administration?
I mean, it's still pretty early days. We've had a few names now. I think the dominant theme is around loyalty over necessarily sort of policy substance. That you know, particularly in Elise Stefanik, who will be his ambassador to the United Nations, somebody who is an absolute Trump loyalist, doesn't particularly have foreign policy or diplomatic experience. So a lot of the picks, it appears, in the early stages are being made on that basis. I think he's trying to avoid, particularly in foreign policy, some of the issues he had with people like John Bolton and others in the first administration, that he simply did things that they thought were a terrible idea. And that led to a lot of turbulence very early on in the administration. So there is clearly an attempt to try to stem that before it can even happen. But given, I think, some of the things that were talked about on the campaign trail, there is a sense that I think a bit of that is almost inevitable.
Tom Bateman in Washington, thank you very much indeed.
The last post has been sounded, the poppy wreath laid for the remembrance ceremonies But yesterday in Parliament, MPs were worried about future conflicts and whether the UK will be spending enough on defence. Our correspondent, Susan Hume, reports.
Yesterday was the commemoration of the armistice, the day in 1918 that marked the finish of the conflict that the writer H.G. Wells reckoned would be the war that will end war. Of course, it wasn't, and it still hasn't.
War in Europe, conflict in the Middle East, growing threats globally.
Our army is the smallest since the Napoleonic era.
This country might be directly at war within the lifetime of this Parliament.
Given that worrying climate, Labour promised in its election manifesto to raise the UK's defence spending to 2.5% of national income. But there's no exact date on it, and at the weekend, Darren Jones, the minister who's number two at the Treasury, would not commit to reaching that goal before the next election. In the Commons, the Shadow Defence Secretary, James Cartledge, demanded answers about that and about reports of a defence procurement freeze.
2.5% is not an end in itself. The key reason in April we set out a fully funded multi-year pathway to 2.5% was to enable the MOD to procure at pace and at scale the munitions we need to urgently replenish our stocks to war-fighting levels. With the whole world wanting to buy more munitions, we cannot afford to delay any further.
The Defence Secretary, John Healey, insisted the commitment to spend 2.5% of income on defence was cast iron. A pathway to reaching it would be set out in the spring after the current review of defence needs was complete. And he scoffed at the idea that the previous government had truly been planning to spend that amount on defence.
14 years his Conservative government had to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP. And it wasn't a plan or a pathway from the last government, as the Shadow Defence Secretary tries to claim. It was a political ploy. It was announced 4 weeks before they then called the general election. It was unfunded. It was a con on the armed forces and on the British people.
The Labour chair of the Defence Committee, Tam Desi, was still anxious to know that everyone in government, and perhaps he meant the Treasury, was on the same page.
I have a great deal of time and respect for the Secretary of State because I know he gets it. But my question is, do others in government understand the gravity of the situation? Because we need clarity, we need a timetable.
John Healey promised him that ministers did all understand the threats, and spending had already been increased by nearly £3 billion in the budget. Speaking for the Lib Dems, Helen Maguire turned to the election of Donald Trump for a second term as US president. She was not reassured.
We're deeply concerned about the impact of the US elections on Ukraine and Europe. President Trump is an unreliable partner, and within days of his election, the US's support to Ukraine is regrettably now under question.
And she felt that was why we needed to ratchet up our defence spending. However, the Washington Post has reported that President-elect Trump has already spoken to Vladimir Putin, warning him over Ukraine. The Kremlin denies the phone call took place, but John Healey hoped it had.
If reports are right that President Trump has already spoken with President Putin and warned him against the escalation that we see from Russia in Ukraine, this is a very good first step.
A Conservative, Sir Bernard Jenkins, said we were going to have to bust a gut to rearm on a level not seen since the 1930s.
Can I encourage him that we start telling the truth, that we're going to spend, have to spend, far more than 2.5% of GDP on defence within quite a short number of years, with a former chief of general staff warning that this country might be directly at war within the lifetime of this Parliament.
Indeed, of the 30 or so MPs who got up to speak, nearly all talked about the need for more defence spending. But the former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who now sits as an independent, looked at the issue from a different angle.
What actions are being taken by him and by his government to try to bring about a cessation of these conflicts, a cessation of the global tension in order to globally be able to reduce defence expenditure so some of that money can be used to deal with the serious environmental and inequality issues that face this planet?
John Healey said he couldn't wish away the threats, which is why the government needed to make sure the country had the defences to deter those who'd do us harm.
And you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio. Now, the UK has an opportunity to lead the world in the industries of the future by making Britain a clean energy superpower. That's the message from the Prime Minister, who arrived last night at the COP29 climate summit in Azerbaijan. There will be extra subsidies for wind power. The government's already lifted restrictions on onshore wind. There's a £1 billion boost to domestic manufacturing of turbine blades in Hull, as we were hearing earlier. But the world context is changing, and domestically, will Keir Starmer react to the political failure of Bidenomics by slowing up more politically contentious changes, or accelerating, perhaps? Joining me now is Tom Rivett-Carnac, co-host of the Outrage and Optimism podcast and former advisor to the UN Climate Change Convention, who helped develop the strategy that led to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
What should we be looking for as regards the UK at this COP29 conference?
Well, one of the pieces of good news that we're witnessing here in Baku is that the UK is back. And that's a very welcome factor. The domestic actions that the UK is taking do matter internationally in terms of credibility. The clean energy commitments are among the most ambitious. No new oil and gas, lifted the ban on onshore wind. And I think what we'll see today is a nationally determined commitment that's in line with the science. So that's 81% by 2035 is what we're expecting. Now, of course, on climate change, we can always go further. And as the emergency increases, we need to accelerate the degree of ambition. But that's very good. And lots of countries are now looking at the UK and saying, can this be done and bring the British population with them by focusing this on cost of energy, cost of living? And I think if that can be achieved, it will have a big impact.
So to be clear for listeners, this is 81% decline from 1990 levels, excluding aviation. Given the size of Labour's majority, and, you know, we're just a few months into a five-year parliament, could they be more ambitious in terms of the more politically contentious things here?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I think that actually now is the moment for Labour to step up and go further. But in terms of the nationally determined commitment, 81% is what is recommended by the Climate Change Committee. That's in line with the long-term trajectory. So I can see why they're pitching it there. And really more important to me is the language they're putting around why they're doing this. They're not talking about this from climate change ideology or green agenda ideology. They're talking about it because it will help people in the UK. It will help with the cost of living. It will drive down the cost of energy. That's the pathway by which we actually try and deal with this and don't see political pushbacks such as has happened in the US.
And you think that there's lessons to be learned from what's happened very recently in the States?
Well, I think what we can see there is that you can't engage in a long-term transition of an economy while leaving half the population behind. There's now, you know, climate change is a culture war in the US, and it's basically impossible to talk about this in a coherent way that brings the right of the country with you. That needs to change in the US. We were sort of on the edge of that becoming an issue in the UK under Rishi Sunak's government. And I very much hope that what we'll see in the coming years is as these investments are made by Labour, that actually really resonates with people who are struggling with the cost of living, because that's how this becomes a permanent shift in our economy towards clean energy rather than a political football.
Now, you've been doing this for decades. I think one of the ironies here is that the West has pushed net zero, climate change, and yet it's China that seems to have reaped the economic rewards from that. Can this be achieved whilst, as the new US administration might want, isolating China economically?
Well, one of the interesting things that we're going to see now is that Xi Jinping is already blaming Chinese domestic problems on the United States trying to isolate China. So I think what we're going to have to see is China stepping up and everybody stepping up and going further. China tends to underpromise and overdeliver on the international stage, but we know that the vast majority of investments in clean energy have been made in China. And actually, they now have an opportunity to lead the world. They have said they're going to peak emissions by 2030. We actually think they may have done that already. I expect we will see here in Baku and next year in Brazil, China taking the mantle of leadership from the US and saying they're going to go further and faster.
Thanks very much, Tom Rivett-Carnac, there talking to us from Baku.
It is 7 minutes to seven. And for those that have struggled and failed so many times to give up cigarettes, or for those whom the struggle does not seem as if it's worth the effort, a rather huge helping hand is about to be available. A once-a-day pill that helps reduce the desire for nicotine and loosens the grip of addiction is at hand and will be provided by the National Health Service, and with the possibility of saving thousands of lives and improving the life quality of many, many more. Dr. Sarah Jackson is Principal Research Fellow at UCL's Tobacco and Alcohol Research Group. Good morning.
Morning.
How does the drug work? Why is it so different?
Well, varenicline works on the same receptors in the brain as nicotine. So what it does is it effectively blocks nicotine's effect on the brain. So this reduces people's cravings to use nicotine, and it helps to reduce the withdrawal symptoms that people experience when they try to stop smoking. So symptoms like feeling irritable or having trouble sleeping. And together, these two effects make it easier for people to quit successfully.
And it's very different then from patches and gum and vapes in that it's not a substitute for nicotine. People will be no longer ingesting nicotine, and then the hope is that the addiction will wear away.
Exactly. A lot of people, when they try to stop smoking, like the idea of giving up all nicotine completely. Yeah. So some people just don't like the idea of using a vape or a nicotine patch. They want to give it up completely. And this drug gives them a very good option to do so that's known to be effective.
And the numbers are very good. I mean, as far as you can project, the numbers of lives that might be able to be saved. And of course, it's not just lives, is it? It's about the quality of lives of smokers and ex-smokers as well.
Exactly. Smoking's incredibly harmful, and the sooner people quit, the more healthy life expectancy they're able to recover. So the availability of varenicline can help more people to quit and avoid these years of ill health and early death. We've done some modelling work at UCL to estimate the potential impact of varenicline, and we have calculated that it could help around 85,000 people to try to stop smoking each year. And over the next 5 years, its use could potentially prevent up to 9,500 smoking-related deaths. So it really has the potential to make a meaningful contribution to improving health.
Now, there is a tagline along with the tablet, which is that when used alongside behavioural support, which is generally thought to be, you know, some sort of advice or counselling, is that actually available to people? If significant numbers of people say, right, I want to get this tablet, will they also get the kind of support, the counselling that they need?
Yes, so the drug is going to be available from Stop Smoking Services, and their gold standard provision is prescription medication, so in this case varenicline, along with behavioural support, so counselling on how to quit and tips and advice on how to make the most success come from your quit attempt.
This drug was around before, wasn't it, under a different name, but it was withdrawn because, what, impurities were found. You must be, presumably, you're delighted that it has come back onto the market and that the NHS is going to prescribe it.
Yeah, it's really excellent news. So there was a branded version available up until mid-2021. Some people might know it as Champix. It was supplied by Pfizer. But they, as you said, detected an impurity in the drug above their acceptable levels, so withdrew it as a precaution. But the new relaunched generic product has now been approved as safe by the Medicines Health and Regulatory Authority, so there's no concerns about using this form of varenicline.
And no,
there's been generic varenicline available in other countries
right
for a long time now. It just hasn't been available in England.
And no concerns also about finding the money on the NHS because the payback is so large.
Exactly. Smoking costs the NHS so much money that for every smoker we can help to quit, the rewards are huge.
Dr. Sarah Jackson from UCL Tobacco and Alcohol Research Group, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
On Thursday, Radio 4 takes a sideways look at science.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
And this is the infinite monkey hedgerow.
He was unable to write a funny joke for the introduction. That's basically the point.
The new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Science with funny bits.
Science with bits.
Funny science plus bits. So the reason that the Neanderthals died out, you're claiming, is because they weren't astronomers.
Is that... Yes, exactly. That's why.
This is how we investigate cybercrime. We look for the yachts.
The new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Starts this Thursday morning at 11.
It is 7:02. What does the best weather in the world have waiting for us with the weather forecast? Here's Sarah Kate Lucas. Morning, Sarah.
Thanks, Johnny. Well, we've got a dry, settled theme to our weather once again. So big area of high pressure still holding on to the weather through today and for much of the week ahead as well. So predominantly dry, but not quite everywhere. There's a bit more of a breeze blowing across parts of southeast England and East Anglia. And that breeze coming in from the northeast is going to bring a few showers. So showers coming and going here, especially so for parts of Kent, but there could be one or two drifting elsewhere across the region. So quite blustery down towards the southeast, lighter winds elsewhere. We have got some mist and some fog patches, and across parts of Northern Ireland, that fog is really extensive and quite dense, actually, first thing. Also some fog for southwest Scotland, northwest England, into the West Midlands and North Wales too. So if you have got the mist and fog, it'll be slowly going to be clearing through the day. Sunny spells developing and light winds for most of us away from the southeast and the far north too. Top temperatures today ranging between about 10 to 12 for most, probably the mildest weather up towards the Western Isles, where we could see 13 or 14 degrees. And then as we head through this coming night, we've still got dry weather continuing, some clear spells as well. So another chilly night, a bit like last night. There'll be a touch of grass frost around 2 to 4 for most of us, and some fog patches tomorrow. Could be quite extensive across central and northern parts of the UK. Into tomorrow, we're looking at another dry day with sunny spells continuing. Could be a few showers just moving into the northwest, and they're just drifting across Scotland and Northern Ireland through the morning into Northern England by tomorrow afternoon. But most of us should be staying dry once again, 10 to 14 degrees. It looks like the dry theme continues as we head through the working week, but it turns more unsettled with some rain pushing south as we head through the weekend.
It is the most wonderful weather in the world. Thank you so much, Sarah Cuth-Lucas there. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Faisal Islam and Johnny Diamond.
It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 12th of November. The headlines. Two doctors and a High Court judge would need to approve a request from a terminally ill person to end their own life under plans to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales being set out today. Sir Starmer says he's setting a difficult but achievable new target for the UK to cut carbon emissions over the next decade. And cyclists are being warned of the dangers of tracking down thieves who steal their bikes.
Later on the programme, as calls continue for the Archbishop of Canterbury to go off over his handling of church abuser John Smythe, we hear from a survivor of that case.
I believe that now is an opportunity for him to resign. This would be an opportunity for him to stand with the victims of the Smythe abuse and all victims who have not been treated properly by the Church of England in their own abuse cases.
With fewer than 3% of bike thefts leading to criminal charges, we will talk to the cyclists taking things into their own hands. And
here we go again. New season, new titles, new managers, new signings. But apart from that, nothing much has really changed.
It is all change at Match of the Day. As its presenter, Gary Lineker, stands down, we'll speak to a former Director General of the BBC after the news. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he will not pressure Labour MPs to vote either in favour or against proposals to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales. The bill says two doctors and the High Court need to be satisfied that a terminally ill adult is eligible before approval is granted. The House of Commons will debate the bill on Friday, the 29th of November. Our political correspondent Hannah Miller reports.
9 years have passed since MPs rejected assisted dying. In 2.5 weeks, they will have the chance to vote again. The Labour MP who drafted the bill, Kim Leadbeater, says the new legislation contains the strictest safeguards in the world. Only adults expected to die within 6 months would be eligible. They would need to have the mental capacity to make a choice about the end of their life. Two independent doctors would have to be satisfied that the person has made that decision voluntarily, with a delay of a week between their assessments. The case would then go before a High Court judge to be approved. The medication to end life would have to be self-administered. Doctors would not be allowed to do it, and anyone found to have coerced someone into taking their own life would face a prison sentence. The Conservative MP, Danny Kruger, a long-time opponent of assisted dying, said he respected the efforts made to draft the bill tightly, but could not vote in favour because it would change the whole nature of society's attitude to the most vulnerable. Sir Keir Starmer said it would be for every MP to decide for themselves how they want to vote, pointing out that a lot will depend on the detail.
The UK is set to announce new targets to cut carbon emissions at the COP29 conference in Azerbaijan. Sir Keir Starmer has described the approach as difficult but achievable. From the conference in Baku, our political correspondent Alex Forsyth.
On the second day of the COP summit, the UK is keen to be seen as a global leader when it comes to addressing climate change. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to set out ambitious new targets to reduce UK emissions by 81% compared to 1990 levels by 2035, based on recent recommendations from the Climate Change Committee. The Prime Minister insisted this could be done without telling people what to do when it came to things like heating systems or taking flights.
It will be ambitious. It's measured by making sure that we get to clean power by 2030. That's the single most important target on the way to the emissions. And that will bring with it lower bills for people for their energy. It'll give them independence so that tyrants like Putin can't put his boot on our throat, causing all sorts of difficulties for our energy bills. And it comes with the next generation of jobs.
There are nerves in Baku about the prospect of Donald Trump once again pulling the US out of international climate agreements. Sir Keir wouldn't be drawn on the president-elect's views on climate change, but said he looked forward to working with him and other world leaders on the issue.
A court in Edinburgh will begin hearing a legal challenge to the approval of drilling in the UK's largest untapped oil field. The case is being brought by the environmental groups Greenpeace and Uplift. They're trying to stop the development of the Rosebank field off Shetland, as well as the Jackdaw gas field in the North Sea. Donald Trump has been making more appointments in readiness for his return to the White House. He's picked a former Republican congressman, Lee Zeldin, as the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Zeldin, who's often voted against green legislation, will be expected to deliver on the president-elect's pledge to resume new oil and gas production in the US. The most eye-catching potential appointment is for the job of America's top diplomat. US media is reporting that the Florida senator and former Trump rival Marco Rubio is in line for the post. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Senator Rubio is considered to be one of the most hawkish and right-wing candidates for Secretary of State. He'll be expected to be tough on America's foes, among them China, Iran and Cuba. The war in Ukraine is one of the most pressing issues for the incoming Trump administration. The president-elect has often said he will end that conflict swiftly, without detailing how. Marco Rubio has said in recent interviews there will need to be a negotiated settlement and that Ukraine could not expect to regain all the territory occupied by Russia. He's also voted against providing US military aid to Ukraine and argued in favour of Mr. Trump's America First isolationist foreign policy stance, which aims to keep the US out of involvement in overseas conflicts. The appointment has not been officially announced, and Mr. Trump could yet change his mind. A central role for Senator Rubio is a far cry from when Mr. Trump nicknamed him Little Marco when they were rivals for the Republican Party nomination in 2016.
An improved anti-smoking pill is to be made available on the NHS in England. The drug is a new version of one that was withdrawn 3 years ago. It's regarded as being as good as vaping when it comes to helping people to quit and more effective than nicotine patches. The BBC is expected to make an official announcement later today confirming the departure of Gary Lineker from Match of the Day. He's set to leave the programme at the end of the Premier League season next May. It's understood his final job for the BBC will be presenting coverage of the 2026 World Cup. More from our culture editor, Katie Razzle.
Gary Lineker is leaving the BBC. But the former England striker-turned-presenter will go out on a high, fronting the biggest football tournament in the world. Neither the BBC nor Gary Lineker has commented on the Sun's report, but I understand the presenter was open to staying on at Match of the Day. After more than a quarter of a century at the helm, the BBC didn't offer him a new contract for the show. The corporation has a new head of sport, and with Lineker's current contract coming to an end, a different agreement has been reached. Gary Lineker has been involved in controversy over his use of social media and was briefly suspended by BBC bosses over a post. His fellow presenters took his side and refused to present Match of the Day without him. Some may be happy to see the back of a man paid more than £1.3 million a year by the BBC. Others will recognise the risks of losing him. Replacing a famous presenter on a high-profile show is a high-stakes game.
Three American airlines have suspended flights to Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, after gunfire struck a plane as it was landing. The Spirit Airlines flight from Florida was forced to divert to the neighbouring Dominican Republic. One of the cabin crew was injured, but no passengers were hurt. The charity Cycling UK says there's a growing trend of people attempting to trace their stolen bikes, despite police warnings about the risk of confronting thieves. BBC analysis of police figures for England and Wales suggests that fewer than 3% of reported bike thefts since 2019 have resulted in a charge or summons. Francesca Osborne reports.
Cyclists have told the BBC that they've resorted to dangerous methods to find and get back their stolen bikes, but claim it's their only hope of retrieving them. One man from Bristol who used a GPS tracker hidden in the bike frame said he was threatened when he tried to reclaim it. Others explain how they've scoured social media marketplaces and confronted the online sellers. Police forces advise people against taking action themselves, as it may put them at risk and be detrimental to investigations. The National Police Chiefs Council says it understands victims' disappointment and is working hard to improve the experience of those affected. In cases where there's not enough information for police to bring criminal proceedings, it says officers focus on targeting prolific offenders, organised crime networks and prevention measures.
Francesca Osborne reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven. After what's already been a fair amount of debate about the broad principle, we now have the detail of Labour MP Kim Leadbeater's proposed bill to enable assisted dying to take place. As we were hearing in the bulletin, it will have, says the MP, the strictest safeguards in the world. It is for those with a terminal illness who are expected to die within 6 months. Two independent doctors would have to declare that they are satisfied that the person involved had come to the decision voluntarily, and a High Court judge would need to make the final approval. I'm joined by Fergus Walsh, our medical editor. Good morning, Fergus. It appears to be bound about by medical safeguards.
Yes, and there are 43 clauses in this bill, many, many more than in a very similar bill introduced in the House of Lords early this year by Lord Falconer. And I get the sense in reading it that there is a real attempt by Kim Leadbeater to try to reassure undecided MPs that the safeguards will be in place to try to prevent any type of coercion, anything going wrong here. And they want to model this on the system in Oregon, where assisted dying has been legal since the late 90s, and where just under 1% of all deaths, about 0.8% of all deaths now take place with assisted dying. But critics, of course, will say no matter what safeguards you put in place, a right to die will soon become a duty to die. And there'll be, if not explicit, there'll be implicit coercion, and people will feel that they have to opt for an assisted death so they're not a burden.
You've clearly been looking around the world a wee bit for comparisons. Where does it sit on the spectrum of safeguards and the tightness of those safeguards compared to other countries which have this legislation in place?
Well, no other country has this safeguard of a High Court judge. So that would place it right at the end of the most strict safeguards anywhere in the world. It doesn't include intolerable suffering. There's no mention of the word suffering in the bill because there are concerns from Kim Leadbeater and others that if you opened it up to people who are not terminally ill, then it really would be potentially open to abuse. So countries like Canada, interestingly, started out restricting it to the terminally ill in 2016, but there was a legal challenge there. And since 2021, it's been open to those with intolerable physical or psychological suffering. Intolerable suffering is also one of the ways in which you can access it in the Netherlands, Belgium, or Switzerland. But the supporters, Kim Leadbeater, would say, no, look, Oregon's had this system in place since the 90s. It hasn't been extended. Please look there, because that is the system they are most closely trying to follow.
What about people in the medical community, those you're in touch with day in, day out? Do you think this will satisfy them?
Well, it will satisfy some, but not others. It is striking that a lot of palliative care and end-of-life care doctors are opposed to this, not all. The medical profession, from being outright hostile to this idea years ago. Some organisations are now much more sitting on the fence. It will be under the bill. There'll be no compunction on any doctor to take part in this. There will be opposition from many in the medical profession. But, you know, supporters say that the current system effectively condemns some people to an undignified and intolerable end, because palliative care cannot always provide a pain-free death. And those who can afford it can still go to Dignitas. You know, well over 500 Britons have ended their lives at Dignitas, something like 40 last year. And they argued that leaving that there, we're ending with the worst of all possible worlds, because Dignitas is not regulated by the UK Parliament.
No, and you are, by its very nature, it's in Switzerland, you're a very long way away from the relatives and people you may wish to be around at that point. Fergus, thank you very much indeed. Fergus Walsh, our medical editor there. I think we're going to talk about Gary Lineker in a bit, aren't we?
Indeed, later today, somewhere else in this building, the BBC is expected to make official the departure of broadcaster and former England star Gary Lineker from its flagship football show Match of the Day. And eventually, after the next World Cup, he'll leave the BBC altogether. Lineker is one of the highest paid presenters at the BBC and has not commented yet, but is not believed to have been offered a new contract. Last year, Lineker was briefly taken off air after a row over his social media criticism of the Conservative government's illegal immigration plans. He's now built up his own media empire of successful podcasts, including The Rest is Politics. Who better to talk about this than the former DG of the BBC and chairman of the FA, Greg Dyke? Greg, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So, is this a big loss to the BBC?
Well, yes, it's a big loss, but life moves on. Match of the Day will continue. They'll have a new presenter, just as when Des Lynam left and Gary Lineker took over from him 20 years ago.
Indeed, and you were the DG when he took over.
I was, yes. And he's become a brilliant presenter and a big personality, and has been a good performer for the BBC. But, you know, life moves on. Presenters don't stay forever. And in the end, people watch Match of the Day for the football.
Indeed. And obviously, when you, I mean, you maybe didn't approve directly this job, but, you know, obviously he was an England legend footballer and you brought him in as the main presenter.
Well, I remember I was at ITV when he first became a television personality. And I have to say, he wasn't a great presenter in those days, but he grew into the job and to the BBC, and has been brilliant for the BBC. He is without doubt the outstanding sports presenter of his time. But as I say, the, you know, presenters move on. What in the end, people watch the program.
Yeah. But the impact he has had on this?
I think he and those Alan Shearer and others that are around him have become a fun team to watch. They never took football; they took it seriously, but without ever thinking that it's life and death. But I think he's been a very good presenter of Match of the Day, and I suspect that whoever replaces him will be the same.
And if it's right, as has been reported, that he wasn't offered a new contract, is that a mistake?
I don't know if that is the case. I heard it was by mutual consent. But, I mean, we all know how much he earns. He's very expensive. The BBC is in difficulties financially. And, you know, it would be a saving on a sports budget, which you could use elsewhere. So that will be the sort of decisions that will be taken. I don't know if he was offered a new contract or not.
It's difficult not to notice that this comes a year after that almighty row with the then government and your successor as Director General, and having to do a special deal on his social media use.
Well, yes, whether this is anything to do with that, you can't, I don't know. And as I understand it, neither side will say that it was. I personally, at that time, I mean, it's one of the few times that I've disagreed with the BBC since I left. I thought that he was a sports presenter, and therefore what he was saying about politics was irrelevant to his performance as a presenter.
Oh,
but it's there in the background, so it must have been a thought in the mind of whoever took the decision.
Greg Dyke, thanks for joining us on Gary Lineker, and more on that later.
It is 18 minutes past seven. Unemployment edged up slightly in the 3 months to September. That's according to figures just released by the Office for National Statistics. Will's been hunched over those figures, and he's back with more on that.
Yeah, I've been skimming through those, Johnny, in the last kind of 18 minutes or so since we got them. UK unemployment rate was 4.3%, up 0.1 on the previous quarter. And the data from the Labour Force Survey also showed that the rate at which wages were rising, a key input when the Bank of England is looking at those interest rates, they also eased again. They grew at 4.8%. That's the slowest pace of growth since the summer of 2022. Liz McEwen, the Director of Economic Statistics at the ONS, is with us. Liz, morning.
Good morning.
I want to come to what those tell us in a bit more detail in a moment, but you've also got this note that's come with the numbers again about the ongoing issues you've got with the Labour Force Survey. And this is the first set of numbers that have come out since the Bank of England's chief economist, Hugh Pill, had a letter by Freedom of Information published in the Financial Times criticising the survey, saying it was making their job nigh on impossible when it came to setting interest rates. Where are we with the quality of the survey?
Well, we do recognise there's real challenges at the moment with our labour force survey. That's in common with other household surveys around the world, which saw response rates fall both during and after the pandemic. We've taken a large range of measures to address those issues. We've boosted the sample. We've increased incentives. We've returned to face-to-face interviewing.
And is that working? Because Hugh Pill in this letter said that he didn't see any response to that, that rates weren't going up. He talked about it being about 19% when he had written this letter back in the spring. I mean, has it gone up from that?
So numbers published this morning show that our latest quarterly data set now includes some 59,000 individuals, and that's around 15,000 more than it was at its lowest point. So I think that shows that while we recognise, of course, there's more that we need to do here, progress has been made since we implemented the plan. Of course, we do recognise that those challenges are affecting the Bank of England and other users who rely on the data. We're very regularly discussing those issues with them, and in particular, discussing how our improvement plans are progressing.
Is that going quickly enough, though?
Well, one of the challenges is when you introduce improvements to the survey, because of the way the survey is structured, those changes do take time to feed fully through. And that's what we're seeing at the moment, that we've introduced the measures and they will take time. And while they are taking time, what we are encouraging all users to do is look at the large range of data, of alternative data sources that we're publishing. So today we didn't just publish Labour Force Survey estimates. We also have data from payroll estimates, from HMRC data, and we have surveys for businesses. So when we look at all those information sources together, we're getting a rich picture of the labour market, and that's helping us while we continue
just quickly
to address
contextualise the headline unemployment number for us.
So what we're seeing across the data that we published this morning is a continued easing of the labour market, albeit from a historically tight starting point. So we're seeing that across earnings, where they've continued to ease this month, now at 4.8%. They're still relatively high, but they're down from the peaks that we saw in 2023. And we've also seen a continued decline in the number of job vacancies and continued slowing growth in those payroll employees. That's the data from HMRC.
That's becoming a bit of a trend now, isn't it? Liz, thanks so much for your time this morning. Liz McEwen, the Director of Economic Statistics at the ONS.
Thanks, Will, there with the latest as unemployment ticks up. Now, we've done a lot on this programme on the sewage crisis and a lot also on the fashion for cold water swimming. Well, those two stories are merging into one this morning, with changes being proposed for the system of monitoring water quality. Until now, this monitoring occurs over summer, but it could be extended in recognition of changing bathing and swimming habits and to help the more adventurous and thick wetsuited surfers and bodyboarders too. Let's put some of that to Kirsty Davis, Community Water Quality Manager at Surfers Against Sewage. Thanks for joining us, Kirsty. Is it a necessary change?
Yeah, absolutely. We really welcome this consultation at Surfers Against Sewage. It's a real opportunity and positive step forward to reform outdated legislation. It's no longer fit for purpose, as it doesn't really represent where we swim, where we paddle, where we surf in our rivers, lakes and beaches recreationally.
And is it necessarily worse during winter because it rains more and there are more overflows, which we've all become familiar with over the past year or so?
Yeah, that's right. We typically get drier weather in the summer periods where the bathing season currently is monitored. So monitoring only happens during May to September at the moment in Wales and England. But we know that people use their rivers, lakes and beaches all year round to swim, surf and paddle, both for mental and physical health benefits. And monitoring water quality for public health and for the environmental health is vital if we're going to see improvements to drive change.
But there may have been some strategy in not monitoring it outside of the summer because it just affects fewer people, I suppose. And the net result is that they'll have to take action and this might get passed on in terms of water bills.
The government needs to ensure that the regulator and the polluter have this accountability. The legislation at the bathing water, that it states that the responsibility falls with those regulators and polluters to fulfil a responsibility to clean up the waters. So that has to be fulfilled in those roles.
Now, this issue achieved great salience during the general election, became a big issue thanks to the campaigning of yourself. Do you see any change under the new government in terms of addressing this issue?
Well, I think the consultation day is a first step, a positive first step, but obviously with the bigger reform of the sector that's been announced as well, I think this is a trigger, and it's a way for the public to speak up about their well-loved waterways, to influence change, and also for the government to enforce this legislation with urgency, to show that they really mean that they want to clean up our waterways for the benefit of the public and for the environment.
And when you but there's been no change in terms of the quality of the water. I mean, it's too soon to see any change such as that in anywhere where you're surfing, for example, or anywhere where people are cold water swimming.
Yeah, currently there's been no sort of change and improvement. But I think with this legislation, with it being more and more documented, and I think more people speaking up, having the opportunity to speak up about the issue through this consultation is a really positive, well-documented step. But we need to ensure that the government are progressive. We don't feel this consultation is quite as progressive as it could be. We're calling for year-round monitoring for water quality that includes other pollutants such as chemicals, and they're the kind of really additional pollutants that are really a threat to human health also.
Kirsty Davis there from Surfers Against Sewage. Thanks for joining us.
It's 26 minutes past seven. That means it's sports time and Mike Williams is back.
Well, Johnny, Gary Lineker and his departure from Match of the Day might be dominating all of the newspaper front pages this morning, but there is a different, more serious football story on every single back page today. Top referee suspended over Klopp video rant, say the Times. Ref's video nasty is the Guardian's headline, whilst ref Coot faces boot is the back page on The Sun and The Mirror. This is the suspension announced yesterday of Premier League referee David Coot. The 42-year-old is being investigated after a video allegedly showing him making derogatory comments about Liverpool and the club's former manager Jurgen Klopp was circulated on social media yesterday.
What did you think of the Liverpool game earlier when you were fourth official?
Liverpool.
You think of Jurgen Klopp?
Absolutely. So I did my best not to speak to him.
Well, it's not clear when the video was filmed, and it hasn't been independently verified by the BBC. Well, we can get more now with BBC football reporter Simon Stone, who joins us. Simon, what do we think are the next steps from here?
Well, as you rightly say, we've not been able to verify the video, but a source has told me that the PGMOL's inquiry is treating the video as genuine. And I guess now PGMOL has got to get to the bottom of how this has ended up in the public domain, the sentiments behind it, and what they do if it is proved to be correct with David Coop, because they place as a body integrity above anything else. They have to know that players and managers believe their officials are above any kind of conscious or subconscious bias, and this calls into question. Liverpool are aware of the video, but they're not commenting, and clearly will wait for PGMOL to get to the end of their investigation and decide what they're going to do around David Coop.
Any word on this from Liverpool yet, or from David Coote himself?
No, as I say, Liverpool are aware of it, but they're not commenting. And I did send messages to David Coote. I didn't get a reply. I think he's obviously going to have to speak to his bosses and explain himself. And it is a very, very difficult situation that PGMOL have to navigate now.
And elsewhere this morning, Simon, another story dominating some of the back pages this morning is Ruud van Nistelrooy's departure from Manchester United. He'd been in interim charge, of course, for four games. This, not a huge surprise.
No, Manchester United put out a statement yesterday saying they were grateful for Ruud van Nistelrooy and everything that he'd done, and he would always be a hero at the club and he would always be welcome back at the club. But I think it was fairly obvious that Ruben Amorim was going to arrive with his own coaching team, long-standing coaching team, some of whom have been with him since he was at Braga over 4 years ago. And there was no real place within that for someone who has his own kind of managerial credentials and has come as part of someone else's backroom team. So I think it was something that people were expecting. Some fans will be disappointed because Van Nistelrooy is a hero to them, but at least it allows Ruben Amorim a clean break for when he gets his work permit, which should be within the next day or two, and that will allow him to start work as soon as the international break is over.
Yes, the Ruben Amorim regime at Old Trafford has begun. Simon Stone, many thanks for that this morning. And just to say, in the next hour of the programme, something completely different, a conversation with a pioneering woman of horse racing. Karen Wiltshire joins us. She was the first woman to win a flat race back in 1978. We'll hear more from her later in the show.
Thanks, Mike. Lots of sport today.
Take a moment with BBC Radio 3 Unwind, the new destination for music to unwind your mind. Set yourself up for the morning with Dr. Sian Williams' selection of soothing classical tracks. And join Oliver Arnold's as you wind down in the evening with Ultimate Calm.
Music that can bring complete peace of mind.
Radio 3 Unwind. Listen on BBC Sounds.
No unwinding at this hour of the morning. Let's take a quick look at the weather. Today will be a bright and dry day for Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. England will see some patchy cloud with the chance of a few showers in the far southeast, where it will also be windy.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Faisal Islam. It's just after 7:30. And now a summary of the news from Caroline Nicholls.
Sir Keir Starmer has insisted Labour MPs will not be pressured to vote a certain way when proposals to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales are debated in Parliament later this month. If enacted, the bill would allow those who are terminally ill with less than 6 months to live to self-administer medication to end their life. Critics say their worried patients could be coerced into dying, but proponents of the bill say safeguards are in place. The Prime Minister is to announce a new UK emissions pledge at the COP29 climate summit in Baku today. It's understood he'll set a target of cutting greenhouse gases by 81% compared with 1990 levels by 2035. Sir Keir has described the goal as difficult but achievable with the use of clean power. A court in Edinburgh will begin hearing a legal challenge to the approval of drilling in the UK's largest untapped oil field. The case is being brought by the environmental groups Greenpeace and Uplift. They're trying to stop the development of the Rosebank field off Shetland, as well as the Jackdaw gas field in the North Sea. Donald Trump is pressing ahead with appointments to his new presidential administration, with US media suggesting he'll name the Florida Senator Marco Rubio as Secretary of State. Mr. Rubio has voted against providing US military aid for the war in Ukraine and has supported Mr. Trump's America First policy, which seeks to keep the US out of foreign conflicts. A number of commercial flights to Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, have been suspended after gunfire hit a plane trying to land. The US flight was diverted to the Dominican Republic. An improved anti-smoking pill is to be made available on the NHS in England. The drug is a new version of one that was withdrawn 3 years ago. It's regarded as being as good as vaping when it comes to helping people to quit and more effective than nicotine patches.
Thank you, Caroline. It is 27 minutes to eight. The stories that have emerged about the abuse meted out by John Smythe, a lay reader in the Church of England, both at Winchester College and then in Africa, are horrible. And some listeners may be upset by what they hear. Stories of boys groomed over years, of regular beatings by Smythe, of dozens and dozens of children and young men who had been persuaded of their own sin, of beatings so brutal that boys were given nappies to soak up the blood. Smythe died in 2018 in South Africa. But an independent review into the abuse that was published last week found that Smythe might have been brought to justice had the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, reported the matter to police when he first heard about it shortly after taking up his office in 2013. The report speaks of a distinct lack of curiosity shown by the Archbishop when he learnt of the allegations, and concludes that Smythe could and should have been reported to the police in 2013. Yesterday, the Bishop of Newcastle, Helen Anne Hartley, became the most senior member of the clergy to call for the Archbishop to stand down, something he says he does not intend to do. The Archbishop's office said yesterday that Justin Welby has apologised profoundly for his own failures and omissions. One of those who had the terrible misfortune to meet John Smythe at an early age was Andy Morse. I spoke to him a short while ago and asked him about the circumstances of how they first met.
Well, I was 14 years old when I first met John Smythe. I was a pupil at Winchester College, and the college held after-chapel services, evangelical Christian meetings, to which John Smythe, as an outsider, was invited to talk. His sort of modus operandi, because I believe he was a predator, even in those days, was that he picked on a few boys within that group, befriended us, invited us back out to lunch at his family home, and slowly over the years became a sort of father figure to me, in the sense that I'd been sent away to school at the age of seven, initially to prep school, and then following that to public school at Winchester. My parents, although very loving and the best parents I could wish to have, were distant. And that was the opportunity that John Smythe saw to infiltrate himself in my life.
So for a few years, he built a relationship with you. And then at a certain point, at a certain age, this turned into a violent physical relationship.
Yes, he was allowed access to Winchester College, to the rooms of a teacher, where during the week he continued his sort of Christian ministry to us, or what he called his Christian ministry. At around the age of 16, 17, he started introducing to me the notion that I was sinning and that I needed to mark those sins in a form of repentance that really would mean something to the Lord. And his suggestion to that was beatings. He drew on various Old Testament verses to support his argument. And those beatings started for us around the age of 17 and continued in my case through until I was 21 and at university.
You maintained this relationship with him, a friendship with him, whilst he continued to treat you with violence. It must have been a very confusing, very difficult relationship for you then and to look at now.
I mean, you say friendship, but over the years it had become more than a friendship. As I think I already indicated, he was trying to be both a father figure, yeah, and also a spiritual father figure. So I was both enamoured by him, but also incredibly scared of him at the same time.
This went on for 4 years, 5 years, and then it reached a head. A crisis occurred for you.
That's right. On my 21st birthday, John Smythe told me that I was still sinning and that that required what he called a special beating. That was beatings of hundreds of lashes of a cane. And I realized that I couldn't take things any longer. I firstly wrote a couple of anonymous letters to Christian leaders and to John Smythe. But when those had no effect, I decided that I would take my own life. And I remember lying on my hospital bed after my suicide attempt, thinking that I was free, that it was over, that I would never see him again, and that I had a whole new life to live. But the mental anguish that the beatings had brought about over the years began to play on my mind fairly quickly. I kept the beatings a secret apart from to my very close family, friends, and a few Christian leaders who I knew. The burden of that secret eventually took its toll on my mental health. And I would tend to say to people, this awful thing has happened to me. Don't worry about it. It's over. It's finished. You don't need to worry about it. And so in a way, I was telling them about the abuse, but at the same time, telling them that I didn't need help, that I could bear it on my own, which of course I couldn't.
The story, the life of Smythe is now out in the open. He is gone, he is dead, but it is out in the open. And there is obviously a lot of discussion about responsibility and accountability within the church. The Archbishop of Canterbury says he knew nothing about this until 2013 and has apologised for failing to act as he might have done when he was told about it in 2013. Is that enough?
I think his admission that in 2013, which is really modern day in comparison to the 1970s, 1980s, that he didn't do enough, that he wasn't rigorous, that he was inactive, is enough, in my mind, to confirm that Justin Welby, along with countless other Anglican churchmen, were part of a cover-up about the abuse, a cover-up that extended until 2017 when Channel 4 reported, and for the first time a proper police investigation was launched. That had nothing to do with the church or Justin Welby or the actions of Lambeth Palace. That was the outside media holding the church to account.
You think the church itself should have been much more active early on? You think there is a problem with the institution and how it has reacted?
Yes, I think even by their own rules, they should have been much more proactive. John Smythe was still alive at this time. We know now he was still abusing teenagers in Africa. So there was plenty of opportunity for that to stop and for the police to become involved. And it is those African lives and the African victims that are very much on my conscience. And I would hope on the Archbishop's conscience too.
The Archbishop says he talked about resigning with colleagues and they said he should not and he has considered it and he will not. Does that satisfy you? Do you believe he needs to leave his post?
I think he should resign. I think the church is incredibly stringent with its rules for everyday vicars and for those lower down the scale about what to do when abuse is reported to you. The Archbishop has himself admitted that he failed in 2013. And I think for that reason, although on a personal level, I know how difficult it is not to hold on to secrets, and particularly secrets in which you yourself come out maybe with a degree of shame. I believe that now is an opportunity for him to resign. And I say an opportunity in the sense that I think this would be an opportunity for him to stand with the victims of the Smythe abuse and all victims who have not been treated properly by the Church of England in their own abuse cases.
That was Andrew Morse speaking to me there. We did ask to speak to the Archbishop of Canterbury this morning, but that request was turned down. Lambeth Palace sent us a statement. It reads, "The Archbishop reiterates his horror at the scale of John Smythe's egregious abuse as reflected in his public apology. He has apologised profoundly, both for his own failures and omissions and for the wickedness, concealment and abuse by the Church more widely. As he has said," the statement goes on, "he had no awareness or suspicion of the allegations before he was told in 2013, and therefore, having reflected, he does not intend to resign. He hopes the Makin review supports the ongoing work of building a safer church here and around the world." That statement from Lambeth Palace. Winchester College told us it acknowledged the courage and determination of the victims in pursuing the truth about John Smythe. The college apologises unreservedly for its part in their terrible experiences. If you have been affected by anything you've heard here, you can find help on the BBC Action Line website. That's bbc.co.uk/actionline, or by phone on 0800 110 100. That's 0800 110 100.
A large gang of forgers, fakers and fraudsters suspected of producing replicas of top artists has been dismantled across Europe by Italian police. The artists included Banksy, Picasso, Warhol and Klimt. And the investigation began last year when Italy's art police seized 200 counterfeits from the collection of a Tuscan businessman in Pisa. I'm glad to say we have Ria Pryor, art journalist and author, to explain. Morning, Ria. How significant, how rare is this?
In terms of significance, it's quite hard to say because obviously details are still emerging, but it definitely has all the features of a sort of classic art forgery case that we would expect today. We've got some big names, you know, you've got Banksy, Picasso, but works at a mid-price, so not the top end of that artist market, which is quite classic for an art forgery case. But in terms of scale, it's definitely one of the biggest ones we've seen in recent years.
And you just expand upon that point about it being mid-priced. What, because sort of psychologically people won't pay at the top end and they may be less suspicious at mid-price?
It's basically down to diligence. I think if you're spending 10 million upwards or even over a million on an artwork, you're necessarily going to conduct a bit more research, do some scientific tests on a work just to establish its authenticity. And naturally, there's going to be more of a paper trail around a work of that scale. Whereas, you know, works that are sitting under 100,000, they're going to have less research, potentially less research around museum displays, exhibitions, etc. So it just makes that scale of scrutiny a little bit less obvious, and it's quicker to move around the market.
That is fascinating. But the key here obviously is that they were being sold as being genuine. But then, caveat emptor here? I mean, if they're paying 100,000 for a Klimt, maybe they should be a little bit more careful.
I mean, I think I might have made a little bit sweeping in terms of just buying it. It's obviously research, but it scales, particularly with things of scientific analysis. I think the thing with forgery is that in some ways that creating the work is fairly easy to do if you can get the right materials and do your research. The difficult bit about getting these works onto the market is the provenance and the sort of surrounding information that goes with it. So, of course, the market's getting a lot better at recording transactions and all the details that go with the work. But you're talking about works that some of them could have been created 100, 200 years ago when the standards and the market was just a different place.
Why should we care if someone overpays for a piece of basically worthless art?
Well, the value of art is always a little bit challenging, very subjective. I think what I've always tried to iterate with art crime is, A, you know, the victims, this is still a substantial portion of their wealth. These works often can be quite high sentimental value. But also we know that art crime is linked to other forms of criminalities. You know, an art criminal doesn't always just, specialise in this one form of criminality. There's these networks and these criminals are working across many different types of crimes, and so the funds that come from it can fund broader criminal networks and collateral. So it's quite a complex picture. It's not always as simple as, you know, just saying it's a rich collector who hasn't done his homework. You know, these are professional criminals that are working across society at a number of different levels. And that's why, you know, police do pay attention. There is a lot of discussion around the degree of resources that should go to art criminality. But, you know, the intel that can come from investigating these type of crimes can be beneficial across society.
It's presumably a lot easier with stencil art to fake than ordinary art.
Yeah, I think what's interesting with the art world, obviously production of art has changed so much. You know, creating a fake of an oil painting is obviously a lot more laborious and takes a lot more research than perhaps running off limited edition prints of an artist or using the internet to recreate digital art. So I think the production of art itself is complicating and opening up more opportunities for criminals. But equally, our ability to detect crime is obviously enhancing as digital platforms and information online increases. So it is a little bit of a game of cat and mouse, as always, between the criminal networks and the authorities that are looking into it.
Well, thanks for that. We're going to have to wrap that there. But I didn't even get to ask you how to spot a fake, but maybe next time. Thanks very much, Ria Pryor.
Coming up in just a moment, why cyclists are taking tracing their stolen bikes into their own hands. But now at 12 minutes to 8, it is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Chinny McDonald, director of Theos, the religion and society think tank.
Good morning. Funny weather we've been having lately. Experts say we're experiencing anti-cyclonic gloom, high pressure leading to grey days and a lack of sunshine. The weather seems to reflect many of our moods, with so many terrible things happening in the world. The dark clouds of fear, the fog of looming catastrophe. In the Bible, the weather often tells a deeper story of what's happening. The wind, the scorching heat, the floods and rains make appearances throughout Scripture. When Jesus is crucified, darkness covers the land and the earth quakes. Beyond UK weather, the COP29 gathering on climate change started yesterday. This week, a report calculated that violent weather cost the world $2 trillion over the past decade. Prime Minister Keir Starmer is at the COP in Azerbaijan, but some world leaders, from China, India, France and the US, aren't. The optics might suggest climate change is lower down the agenda when there's turbulence in other areas of their national politics. It's easy to blame world leaders for not paying attention, but if I'm honest, aside from the occasional sense of dread about the future of the planet, I get distracted by social media feeds and my bank balance and what's for dinner. This idea that none of us is paying attention to the things we should is central to the critically acclaimed Netflix film Don't Look Up. The political satire tells of two astronomers trying to warn humanity of an approaching comet set to destroy the Earth. An allegory of climate change, it frustratingly describes how no one is listening. World leaders are too focused on their own power and political campaigning, while the rest of us numb ourselves with mindless entertainment. The film's title reminds me of the passage in Job. Look up at the heavens and see. Gaze at the clouds so high above you. It's a call to look beyond the immediate, beyond ourselves. On Sunday morning, I took communion with friends. After we'd handed each other bits of broken bread, we held our glasses of red wine in the air and raise toasts to things that give us hope, despite the darkness of the world around us. It reminded me of the moving scene in the film where a group of unexpected friends gather around a table at the end of the world, and one of them says a prayer. He asks God for love to soothe us through these dark times. He prays, may we face whatever is to come with courage and open hearts of acceptance. If our world leaders won't look up, then maybe the least we can do is look around.
That was Thought for the Day with the director of the religion and society think tank Theos, Chinny McDonald. It is 9 minutes to 8.
Well, more crime now. Bike theft, nothing new, but technology is changing the game. The use of trackers in bicycles means that fed-up cyclists can increasingly track exactly where thieves have taken their spoils for weeks, days afterwards. It, and an inability of some police forces to take action, has led rather naturally to a trend, says the charity Cycling UK, of people taking back their bikes or trying to, sometimes confronting the criminals themselves. Is it any surprise when the BBC England data unit has found just 3% of bike thefts result in a charge or a summons? Now, the police advice is against this velo-vigilantism. Let's talk to a couple of experts in this area for different reasons. Jim Waterson is the editor of the website London Centric and a victim of bike theft. And James Dunn is the founder of Backpedal, a company which tracks down stolen bikes. Jim, what happened?
Well, I had my bike, which is an e-bike I use instead of a car. It carries my family. I use it for all my work. And it was taken from outside my house 2 weeks ago. I'd fitted a very basic Apple AirTag tracking device, which is not really designed for this sort of thing, but was a decent backup, and followed it to a block of flats near me. And this is where things got interesting with the police. I said, look, I can tell that this bike is in the corner of this block of flats. And they said, well, we can't come to that because it might be on multiple floors. We don't know which property it is and we don't have the time to do it. So I said, well, I'm going to try and get it back myself. And they said, that's up to you. And this sort of summarizes where we've got to. Eventually, after 3 hours, it moved again and I interrupted someone loading it into the back of a car, and got it back in most of its pieces, lost the wheel. But this is the state we're in now. The police understandably don't have the resources to track down a lot of these things, and technology and people taking it into their own hands is the only way to get back bits of kit that increasingly are being used as people's lifelines, really.
Okay, at this point, I think full disclosure, and this happened before I was given this item to discuss. My bike has also been stolen, and I've got a map up showing it doing a little travel round Acton, Park Royal, and Shepherd's Bush at the minute. So this is not that uncommon, I don't think. Let's bring in James. So you've set up a business recognising that this is quite common, and how does it work? And do you get these bikes back?
Well, first and foremost, Faisal, if you send us the details of your bike after this, we might be able to help you in getting that back. But essentially what we do is we start off with good tracking kit. Jim was actually successful with his Apple AirTag, but what we've done is we've tested lots of different kit and we've figured out which are the best combinations of technology to really give you strong and reliable signals, like kind of wherever the bike ends up going. So it starts off with good tracking kit. And then what happens is if your bike gets stolen, essentially you contact our team and we start working on it straight away. So our head office team will essentially do kind of like all the analysis. So it's like, right, we reckon the tracker is here. We reckon the bike's going to be here. We'll start to annotate the maps and street view, and we'll get these out to our local recovery agents. And these are the guys who do the hard work on the ground. So typically security guys or retired police officers, people who really enjoy this sort of work.
They're kind of hunters. They're hunting down these bikes.
Exactly. So they'll be the ones who get out and we'll kind of guide them over the phone. Like we'll kind of like say, oh, look, check down this alley or check behind here. And essentially they're the ones who will do the hard work on the ground. So like door knocking, getting CCTV off flat managers, essentially whatever they can do to get that bike back as quickly and safely as possible, really.
It sounds like some sort of modern day sport. Let me bring Jim back in here. I mean, was it? You obviously had to make an assessment of the security situation when you looked at the people loading your bike into the back of their car.
I'm afraid I didn't. The adrenaline had just taken over. The police had confirmed that they'd respond if I was stabbed, so I did at least know that there was that backup. But I sprinted into a dark car park and there was a bloke wearing a face covering who, as soon as I said, I mean, I must admit, I stumbled out and just went, I'm terribly sorry, I think that's my bicycle, in a sort of parody of myself. And the bloke was so confused that he just jumped in the front of the car and sped off, leaving the bike behind. But this is not a sort of sustainable model. But equally, the cops don't seem to have the resources to do it. So this is becoming an organized theft. Gangs are involved and people are flipping these for a lot of money very, very quickly on online marketplaces.
Now, I should say, from the National Police Chiefs Council spokesperson, they're saying they recognize how invasive and distressing it is. And they reassure the public the police is taking this very seriously, and they're putting investment in. But they advise against this type of confrontation or potential confrontation. James, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean,
it's obviously why we exist. If the police were out getting back all these stolen bikes, there wouldn't be a need for backpedal. But we started this back in 2021. My partner's bike got stolen. She's a teacher, and that was how she commuted to work every day. And we kind of got in touch with the police, and I could kind of see why they couldn't do anything. Essentially, her bike was stolen from the gym. Two young lads turn up on a moped. One jumps off, cuts it free, and one rides off on a moped, one rides off on her bike. Now, there was no trackers on that bike. Both the lads are in full face helmets, and they're on a stolen moped. So you kind of think, like, what are the angles here for the police to get that bike back? You can see why it wasn't really something they could work on. So that's what got us started on doing it. And I think there's just a lot of gaps in police resource that we okay. can fill. Like, sometimes we'll go out for 3-4 hours at a time. We've recovered over days, weeks, even months okay. before. And that's just kind of unrealistic police resource at the moment.
James, we've got to leave that there. Jim and James, thanks very much. And everybody, whoever did take my bike from Shepherd's Bush, I just warn you, the brakes aren't great.
I'm very impressed you're tracking it live in the studio, Faisal. Now, I wonder what the Strictly judges might make of this.
You heard it here first with Chris McCausland.
Is this a car or a van?
Van.
It's a car. Ah!
The panel show residing in an audio-only world.
What instrument is this?
It's on my birthday.
Where sound clues are used to figure things out.
I'm going to play you a clip of a sport, and you need to see if you can guess the sport from the commentary.
You heard it here first.
Nothing appeared to be happening. It was a commentator, and the sport was commentary practice.
Wednesday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And now for the weather forecast. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Faisal. Well, the dry, settle theme continues for most of us again today. High pressure very much still in charge. Quite a chilly start to the morning with some mist and some fog around. We've also got a bit more of a breeze blowing across the southeast of England. So today that's going to bring a few showers that'll come and go, particularly across parts of Kent, but also Essex, Sussex, parts of East Anglia could see a few of those showers with that brisk breeze close to the coast. But away from this region, a dry day ahead. Morning fog is going to be quite slow to clear from Northern Ireland. We've also got some fog patches for southwest Scotland, northwest England, into North Wales too. But once the fog gradually clears away, we're looking at sunny spells, fairly light winds, and temperatures for most of us between about 10 to 13 degrees. The dry settle theme continues overnight tonight, and like last night, we could see a touch of frost and some mist and some fog patches. More in the way of sunshine tomorrow, and the dry weather lasts over the next few days.
Thanks, Sarah. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Faisal Islam and Johnny Diamond.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 12th of November. The headlines. MPs have until the end of the month to examine a draft law to allow assisted dying in England and Wales before the first vote in the Commons on the issue for almost a decade. The UK is to adopt a tougher target for cutting carbon emissions by 2035. And an improved version of a daily tablet to stop people smoking is being made available on the NHS.
Coming up in the next hour, the Magic Circle is on the hunt for its first female member, whom they threw out after she had posed as a man. We'll hear the incredible story. And
welcome to Match of the Day.
What next for Match of the Day after its presenter Gary Lineker stands down? The BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he will not pressure Labour MPs to vote either in favour or against proposals to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales. The bill says two doctors and the High Court need to be satisfied that a terminally ill adult is eligible before approval is granted. The House of Commons will debate the bill on Friday, the 29th of November. Our political correspondent, Hannah Miller, reports.
9 years have passed since MPs rejected assisted dying. In 2.5 weeks, they will have the chance to vote again. The Labour MP who drafted the bill, Kim Leadbeater, says the new legislation contains the strictest safeguards in the world. Only adults expected to die within 6 months would be eligible. They would need to have the mental capacity to make a choice about the end of their life. two independent doctors would have to be satisfied that the person has made that decision voluntarily, with a delay of a week between their assessments. The case would then go before a High Court judge to be approved. The medication to end life would have to be self-administered. Doctors would not be allowed to do it, and anyone found to have coerced someone into taking their own life would face a prison sentence. The Conservative MP, Danny Kruger, a long-time opponent of assisted dying, said he respected the efforts made to draft the bill tightly, but could not vote in favour because it would change the whole nature of society's attitude to the most vulnerable. Sir Keir Starmer said it would be for every MP to decide for themselves how they want to vote, pointing out that a lot will depend on the detail.
A victim of the most prolific abuser associated with the Church of England has added to calls for the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury. John Smythe died in 2018, having subjected around 130 boys and young men to physical, sexual and psychological attacks, both here and in Africa. A review has concluded Justin Welby could and should have reported Mr. Smythe to the police when he learned about the abuse in 2013. The Bishop of Newcastle has called his position untenable. Lambeth Palace says the Archbishop does not intend to resign. Andy Morse told us Justin Welby should go.
I believe that now is an opportunity for him to resign. And I say an opportunity in the sense that I think this would be an opportunity for him to stand with the victims of the Smythe abuse and all victims who have not been treated properly by the Church of England in their own abuse cases.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand, Christopher Luxton, has made a formal apology to people abused while in the care of the state or religious institutions. In July, the country's longest and most complex public inquiry concluded that more than 200,000 children and vulnerable adults experienced physical or sexual abuse between 1950 and 2019. Mr. Luxton said their treatment had been horrific and heartbreaking, and no apology could right the wrongs of the past. The UK is set to announce new targets to cut carbon emissions at the COP29 conference in Azerbaijan. Sir Keir Starmer has described the approach as difficult but achievable. Reporting from Baku, our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth.
On the second day of the COP summit, the UK is keen to be seen as a global leader when it comes to addressing climate change. Sir Keir Starmer is expected to set out ambitious new targets to reduce UK emissions by 81% compared to 1990 levels by 2035, based on recent recommendations from the Climate Change Committee. The Prime Minister insisted this could be done without telling people what to do when it came to things like heating systems or taking flights.
It will be ambitious. It's measured by making sure that we get to clean power by 2030. That's the single most important target on the way to the emissions. And that will bring with it lower bills for people for their energy. It'll give them independence so that tyrants like Putin can't put his boot on our throat, causing all sorts of difficulties for our energy bills. And it comes with the next generation of jobs.
There are nerves in Baku about the prospect of Donald Trump once again pulling the US out of international climate agreements. Sir Keir wouldn't be drawn on the president-elect's views on climate change, but said he looked forward to working with him and other world leaders on the issue.
A court in Edinburgh will begin hearing a legal challenge to the approval of drilling in the UK's largest untapped oil field. The case is being brought by the environmental groups Greenpeace and Uplift. They're trying to stop the development of the Rosebank field off Shetland, as well as the Jackdaw gas field in the North Sea. Figures out in the last hour show that the UK's unemployment rate increased in the 3 months to September, while pay growth slowed to its lowest level in 2 years. The Office for National Statistics said unemployment rose to an average of 4.3% in that time. Here's our chief economics correspondent, Darshini David.
These figures support anecdotal reports that some businesses already facing higher costs paused hiring ahead of the budget. Although the ONS stressed the main measures of unemployment and employment must be treated with caution due to a very low survey response rate, other indicators, including a fall in the number of vacancies, suggest the jobs market is cooling. Together with weaker inflation, that's meant pay growth eased to an annual rate of 4.8% between July and September, although it's comfortably outpacing inflation for most workers.
The United Nations says Israel has failed to meet a US deadline to increase humanitarian aid supplies to Gaza and limit civilian casualties.
A month ago, the US State Department threatened to withhold arms supplies from Israel if it didn't provide enough aid within 30 days. The US says Israel should be allowing 350 trucks a day through by now, but the UN says that figure has not risen above 150. From Jerusalem, John Donison reports.
Last month, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, demanded Israel took steps to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza. He gave them 30 days to do so. The letter said by now at least 350 lorries of aid needed to be allowed into the strip every day. But the United Nations says for the past month, the average number of lorries per day has been only just over 40. Israel has reopened more crossings into Gaza and disputes those figures. Louise Wateridge from UNRWA, the main UN aid agency in Gaza, said in certain areas Palestinians were starving and fighting to get access to food. For more than a year, much of the death and destruction in Gaza has been done using US weapons. But in the dying days of the Biden presidency, it's unlikely the White House will put its foot down and cut off arms supplies.
Donald Trump has been making more appointments in readiness for his return to the White House. He's picked a former Republican congressman, Lee Zeldin, as the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Zeldin, who has often voted against green legislation, will be expected to deliver on the president-elect's pledge to resume new oil and gas production in the US. Another politician, Mike Waltz, who's a Special Forces veteran, is tipped to become National Security Advisor. The most eye-catching potential appointment is for the job of America's top diplomat. US media is reporting that the Florida senator and former Trump rival Marco Rubio is in line for the post. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
Senator Rubio is considered to be one of the most hawkish and right-wing candidates for Secretary of State. He'll be expected to be tough on America's foes, among them China, Iran and Cuba. The war in Ukraine is one of the most pressing issues for the incoming Trump administration. The president-elect has often said he will end that conflict swiftly, without detailing how. Marco Rubio has said in recent interviews there will need to be a negotiated settlement and that Ukraine could not expect to regain all the territory occupied by Russia. He's also voted against providing US military aid to Ukraine and argued in favour of Mr. Trump's America First isolationist foreign policy stance, which aims to keep the US out of involvement in overseas conflicts. The appointment has not been officially announced, and Mr. Trump could yet change his mind. A central role for Senator Rubio is a far cry from when Mr. Trump nicknamed him Little Marco when they were rivals for the Republican Party nomination in 2016.
Gary Lineker's departure from Match of the Day at the end of the season is expected to be formally confirmed by the BBC later today. He's been presenting the show since 1999. It's understood Gary Lineker will leave the BBC completely in 2026, with his final presenting duties at the World Cup.
Thank you very much, Caroline. It's 8:10. The strictest safeguards in the world. That is what the Labour MP Kim Leadbeater promises in the bill she has set out to legalise assisted dying, one of the great issues of conscience of our times. For some, it is a place that the state should never go. The law, they say, is there to protect life, not enable its ending. For others, sufferers themselves or those who have seen relatives decline and seen their pain in their final months, assisted dying is a simple expression of choice, of human dignity at a time in life when so much of it is stripped away. In between those poles are those who have settled their thoughts about the principles at stake, but are very concerned about what you might call the practicalities, critically important issues about protection of the vulnerable, about checks and balances that might be put in place to minimise the chance of any abusive process, to ensure that those who make the decision to end their lives are doing so without any pressure or duress and are in a fit mental state to do so. Kim Leadbeater joins us in the studio. Good morning. Can you take me through how you see this process happening and what are those strict safeguards?
I can, and thank you for setting out the situation as it stands at the moment. That is the main reason that I've chosen to pursue this piece of legislation, because as it stands, the status quo is not fit for purpose. We've got people having very harrowing deaths, very distressing deaths, both for themselves and for their families. We've got people taking their own lives, and we've got people making journeys to other countries if they can afford to, but often doing so prematurely. So the starting point is a law that's not fit for purpose. And I fully take on board the need to get this piece of legislation absolutely right. And that's why it would be the strictest, the strongest piece of legislation probably in the world. With very clear eligibility criteria, this is just for terminally ill adults. It's not for anybody else. It's for people who are dying. And it is about shortening death rather than ending life. They have to have capacity. They have to have clear, settled and informed consent. And there has to be no coercion or pressure. And we actually make coercion an offence, which it isn't at the moment in this context. There would have to be two doctors involved in the process, two medical practitioners, a very clear, strong initial discussion with the patient. And then after the first assessment by the first doctor, a 7-day reflection period, followed by a second assessment by another independent doctor. After that, there would be oversight from a High Court judge who would have to speak to one of those doctors. So it checks, safeguards and balances the whole way through. After the High Court judge, there would be another 14-day period of reflection. And only then could someone take the journey for unassisted death. So as you can see, layers of safeguards, layers of protections along the way, which make it a very robust piece of legislation, but also address the current failings of the law as it stands.
OK, this is predicated, this idea is predicated on there being a choice between taking your own life and having some assistance in doing so, or going into palliative care, end-of-life care, as exists at the moment. The problem is, and this is Wes Streeting, the health secretary, has made this very clear, is, and this is why he won't vote for it, is that palliative care is simply not up to it at the moment. And he's been very, very blunt about that. Now, if that's the case, and he should know, then there isn't a choice. And people are being offered either a sort of horrible, horrible death or your option. And that's no choice at all.
Look, let's start by saying that we have some of the best palliative care in the world in this country. We have amazing people working day in and day out, supporting people at end of life in palliative care. I've got a local hospice which I visited recently and they do fantastic work. And there's no doubt about it, you're right, there are challenges within the palliative care sector. But the reality is, no matter how good that palliative care is, there are some people whose needs cannot be met. And I've had stories of loved ones, people who've lost loved ones through harrowing deaths, which have taken in some cases hours and in some cases days. And the palliative care sector, as amazing as they are, cannot meet everybody's needs. So that's the first thing to acknowledge. But also, do you know what? Let's have that conversation about palliative care. And I'm really pleased that this bill is facilitating some of those conversations and addressing some of those issues. I had a very good meeting with the Association for Palliative Medicine and I will keep having those conversations. I've met with Hospice UK. Let's turbocharge the need for better palliative care as well. And in some countries where assisted dying has been legalised, palliative care has actually improved. And that's something I would certainly like to see.
Should we not see palliative care in a place where at least the health secretary is happy with it before you introduce this kind of legislation?
Well, look, it's not either or. Some people want the choice of an assisted death and they should have the right to have that choice. But let's look at palliative care alongside that. The other reassurance, I think, is this bill is not going to come into effect overnight. If it does pass the second reading on the 29th of November, there will then be a very robust series of scrutiny throughout Parliament in the new year. It will probably take about 6 months to go through that process. And then there will probably be a period of a couple of years. If it were to become law, it would actually be enacted. So we are just at the start of that journey. And having the conversation about palliative care alongside that, I think, is really, really important.
Does it trouble you at all that the Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has made clear her opposition to the bill? She says she has an unshakable belief in the sanctity and value of human life. It means that's the Health Secretary and the Justice Secretary, the two departments that would be charged effectively with monitoring the process, and both of them are saying, we don't want this.
Well, it will be a free vote. The Prime Minister has made his views very clear, and there are a range of views within Cabinet. There are other Cabinet members such as Liz Kendall, Lisa Nandy, Hilary Benn, who are very supportive of a change in the law. So it's really important to embrace that diversity of opinion. And also, you know, I fully respect Shabana. I've got a good friendship with her. But for her religious beliefs, this isn't something she could vote for. But to be honest, some of the best conversations I've had with people have been with people of faith who have said, look, my faith wouldn't allow me to support a bill like this, but who am I to stop other people having the choice that this would give them? And I've spoken to family and friends from Catholic denominations and others. I met with the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Carey, Rabbi Jonathan Romaine. They are fully supportive of a change in the law due to the suffering that they have seen over their years in their roles. So there is a diversity of opinion within politics. There's a diversity of opinion within religious groups and other groups as well. And that's why this debate is so important. And, you know, whatever happens to the bill, I'm so glad that we're having this discussion. We're talking about death in a way that we don't in this country. We're just not very good at that.
Okay. I want to talk about the detail of the bill, if I may. Fergus Walsh, our medical editor, said that no other country that he'd seen had this final level of decision by a judicial figure, a High Court judge in our case. Isn't it really just a bit of reassuring box ticking having a judge sitting on the top of this? Because all he really does is says, okay, you agree Dr. 1, you agree Dr. 2, fine, okay, off you go. I mean, it's not actually a decision, is it?
No, it is. And I was very clear that this needed to be the case, because when I was looking at the research and looking at what this could look like, what I didn't want was a High Court judge having just piece of paper in front of him and going, tick, 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 yeah, that's all fine. He has to speak to the doctor. He has to speak to one of the doctors involved in the process. He can also speak to the patient if the patient is able to do so. And he can also, I'm saying he or she, obviously, can speak to anybody else that they want to. So if they want to consult a psychiatrist, if they want to consult other people, they can do that. So it is far from a tick box exercise. It's actually a really important extra layer of robust
safety. If they say no, will there be capacity for appeal?
There will be capacity for appeal if the judge says no, yeah.
Right, okay. Lastly, just this question of the old question of slippery slope, and I know this has been gone over a lot, but there is a point here where once you breach the principle that the state is there to protect life, as this does, you then open the way for others to come after you and say, well, okay, you know, terminally ill, death within 6 months was what we thought, but now we're looking at chronic pain, now we're looking at greater length of illness. This will be amendable. Others will come after you and say, we need to take this further.
No, I mean, it won't be amendable. That isn't how it works in this country. Parliament is sovereign. Once this bill is passed, that is the bill.
Well, there's another parliament along in a year, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years.
Well, I think
that's of sovereignty. They can change it.
Given the fact that we haven't debated this issue for 9 years, I feel very confident that once this bill is passed, this will where we stay. And there's other jurisdictions where that's happened. There's places like Oregon where they have not changed the eligibility criteria for over 20 years. And certain states in Australia as well. So if we set it out clearly, this is where the law will be. Other countries have different mechanisms where the courts can get involved. We don't have that. And that's why the courts have sent this issue back to Parliament and said, you must decide. And that's why we've got a duty to do so.
Kim Leadbeater, thank you very much indeed. Well, I'm joined by Sir Ed Davey, leader of the Liberal Democrats. Sir Ed, you heard what Kim Leadbeater had to say. What do you make of the safeguards, the detail that she has put out in this bill?
Well, good morning, Johnny. I should say that I'm speaking in a personal capacity today as an individual MP. I've got huge respect for Kim, and I want to actually thank her for the way she's brought this legislation before Parliament with all the safeguards. I think she's right. We do need to talk about death more, about palliative care. We need a proper debate, and I hope we do get a really proper debate. But having wrestled with this issue for much of my life, I've come down on a different point of view. I'm against this legislation. I think the real problem is, I think the people who are terminally ill and also disabled people and others could feel under real pressure psychologically to end their life. They may not even voice that, but they could feel under real pressure. They could feel themselves a burden. And if we take this decision, I think actually those people will be less free because of that psychological burden.
We have all these checks put in place that Kim Leadbeater is making very clear, you know, two doctors, effectively a cooling off period between nearly every decision that's made, whether it's by the individual involved or by the doctors, even by the judge involved. There's a lot of time there for people to say, hang on, this isn't actually the path that this individual wants to go down. You're not reassured.
No, well, as I say, I think she's done an incredible job in putting these safeguards together, and I don't in any way suggest that this isn't a very, very impressive piece of work. However, the point I want to make is that while I believe people should be free to make their own decisions about their lives, that's fundamental to me as a liberal, my worry is if we go down this route, that won't be the case. Far from being free, lots of people will feel under such pressure psychologically from themselves, not from a, from being coerced, but from themselves to end their lives, and because they could feel a burden. I had to look after my mother when she was terminally ill as a young teenager, and so and I had to administer a lot of pain. She was in, had a very, very painful disease, and in administering that pain relief and talking to her and being there at the end of her life, I came to a different conclusion to the proponents of this bill. Maybe I could have taken a different route, but I came to the conclusion that actually we shouldn't have this this legislation. I think we should focus on better palliative care. And, you know, when people are feeling a burden and then they look at the failings in our health and care system, where, frankly, palliative end-of-life care is far often not good enough, then people may feel they have no choice but to end their lives. And I really think, and I do respect what Kim was saying on your programme completely, but I really think the debate should be on improving palliative care, improving our whole health and care system, which frankly is just not good enough.
Is there, I mean, can you see any set of conditions that you would agree with this, or is this effectively a principled opposition on the grounds that you've laid out, that people may feel pressured, etc., etc.?
Well, although I'm a practicing Christian, practicing Anglican, my views on based on religious beliefs, so I'm not an absolutist in that sense. But I do genuinely worry about people feeling a psychological burden. You know, I've talked about my mother.
Which you're never going to lift from people, presumably.
I mean, I think it's extremely difficult, and that's the challenge in this debate. Can you remove that? And so far, I've not seen any arguments suggest we can.
The flip side of that, and I know you'll be thinking about this as a Liberal Democrat, even if you're here in a personal capacity, the flip side is this issue of individual choice. And that if you can show, as Kim Leadbeater's legislation hopes to, that people are making a free choice of their own will, why is it the state saying no? You are a Liberal Democrat. That is about liberal democracy and the choices individuals make.
It's one of the reasons I've wrestled with this so much, Johnny, and why a number of my colleagues who will take a very different position from me. But here's the point. Rather than it being an increase in freedom, I think people will feel under a lot of pressure. You know, when you're elderly, when you're terminally ill, you know, even people with disabilities, I think they may feel that they've become a burden. They may not voice that, they may not say that, but they may feel like that. I want a society where those people feel valued and the care is there for them. And I, you know, I really worry in the case of people disabled. I have a disabled son. I want people who are disabled to feel more valued. And I feel this approach, I know this is about terminally ill, the bill before it, but the approach of assisted dying, I feel it could undermine that.
Okay.
And I don't want a society where that happens. I want people to feel the care is there, the health care is there, the palliative care is there, and their families will be there with them. And, you know, when I reflect particularly on my mother, but also in talking to many other people going around hospices, there's amazing work that can be done. And I think if we had the highest quality palliative care that was available to all, I think this would change the debate for some people.
We will leave it there. Thank you very much, Sarah Davey. And before that, Kim Leadbeater. Thank you.
Now, the former England star and broadcaster Gary Lineker is expected to leave the BBC's flagship football show Match of the Day and eventually the BBC entirely after leading the BBC's coverage of the next World Cup in the Americas. Here he is reflecting on his time at the programme for a documentary to mark Match of the Day's 50th anniversary.
BBC has had some wonderful football presenters that have hosted Match of the Day.
We begin with the most played fixture in English league history. Aston Villa versus Everton.
Des told me once, he said, I never say joining me tonight, I always say joining us tonight.
It's been a big day at both ends of the table, the top three and the bottom six all in action. Two Premier League winners in the studio, Micah Richards and Joe Hart. Only one of them got relegated.
If you're playing in football, it's probably a dream to play in the World Cup. If you're a presenter of football, you want to present Match of the Day. So sort of to have done both is like two dreams come true, really.
A
Love that music. We understand the official announcement's coming later today. Lineker's clearly obviously one of the highest paid presenters at the BBC, and he was briefly taken off air last year amid a row about his social media criticism of the Conservative government. He's now built up his own media empire of successful podcasts, and let's bring in Alistair Campbell, the former top strategist to Tony Blair and co-host of one of those Lineker podcasts. Alistair, what's your understanding that this was the sort of Beeb push, or was it Gary Lineker's pull, or was it sort of, to use the terminology, six of one, half a dozen of the other?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't involved in those discussions, but I think that Gary's somebody who has got a lot going on in his life, has done Match of the Day for a very, very long time, and I think is established in a really competitive sporting marketplace where the BBC has really struggled to get proper live football, you know, up against Sky and BT and Amazon Prime and so forth, that has kept Match of the Day as a really, really important part of the media furniture and frankly of the national psyche. So I think Gary Lineker can, you know, when he does finally leave, can look back at a remarkable life, both as a brilliant footballer and as a really superb broadcaster. But I was very critical of the BBC at the time that there was that sort of row over what Gary was saying about the government's immigration policies. But whether that was part of this, I have no idea. But I just think that he's really has established himself, not just as a great sportsman, but as a terrific broadcaster.
And that's not a given, is it? To have that combination of somebody who's a genuine sporting legend, loved by the nation, one of the great stories of football of the past few decades was that 1990 World Cup and run to the semi-final, and also be an excellent broadcaster. That is quite rare.
It's not unique, but it is pretty rare. I think that cricket, actually, you've seen far more former really high-level stars going into the game and become very, very good broadcasters, but in football, less so. And I think to do that job, he essentially is not in the Gary Neville, Roy Keane punditry role. He's in the sort of David Coleman, Des Lynam, that role. And I think he was one of the first to come along who was a footballer. And it's interesting. I mean, you know, I was talking to some young people at an event the other day. Gary's name came up, and actually some of them didn't know that Gary Lineker had been a footballer because they just see him as this sort of, you know, this broadcaster and somebody who's become part of the broader political debates. And whether he feels that this will allow him to maybe engage more in those broader debates and focus, as you say, on the stuff that he's doing with his Goalhanger company, I don't know. But I think it'll be a very, very, very hard act to follow.
Do you think the BBC should have tried harder to keep him?
Well, in the end, look, the Match of the Day, the BBC is a massive global brand. Match of the Day is a massive brand within the BBC, and it will survive, I suspect, will survive Gary Lineker, provided that they get the choice right next time round, and there's some pretty good people they can choose from. But, you know, to have done any job in the modern age, to have done any role for over 20 years, I mean, over a quarter of a century he's done that job. I mean, that is a long time in anybody's book. So, look, whether they could have or should have tried to keep him, that's a matter for them. But I think that, you know, leaving where people are basically still thinking you're doing a very, very good job, that's not always the way that people leave big jobs. And you just look at the papers today, you know, Gary Lineker is a very important part of our national kind of conversation. I've just been swimming this morning and people weren't talking about Trump. They weren't talking about the Archbishop. They were talking about Gary Lineker.
But ultimately, you think probably a key reason is that he wants more freedom to talk freely about the issues that he cares about. And he'll get that at his podcast empire, of which, of course, you are a key member.
Well, look, as I say, I don't know, but I think that he's somebody who, when he talks about stuff like immigration, when he talked about, you know, he got involved in the People's Vote campaign that I was involved in, you know, he's somebody who thinks about the world, cares about the world. And maybe I think the BBC, I think it's different for people like you, Faisal, and people who are presenting news and talking about the economy and all these sorts of stuff and politics. But I think the BBC's got itself into a bad place with actually thinking that people, whether they're comedians or whether they're sports presenters, whether they have to be subject to quite the same level of restriction in what they can and can't say about in the political arena. And I think particularly in these sort of polarized times, I think the more that people like Gary Lineker and, you know, others who may be contributors to the BBC, and I accept he's a special case because he's so well paid, Match of the Day is so important, but I think the BBC got the balance a little bit wrong there.
OK, we'll have to leave that there, and you didn't even plug your podcast, so well done for that, Alistair Campbell.
It is 29 minutes to nine. Mike Williams has been in tears all morning at the prospect of Gary Lineker leaving, maybe about to toss your hat into the ring, Mike. Give us the sports.
I think you can count the number of times I've appeared on TV, Johnny, in seconds rather than minutes. I think you and Faisal have got more of a chance.
They're very kind.
But 25 years in the hot seat on that programme. What's the one thing people will always remember Gary Lineker for?
Tell me.
Presenting in his pants.
Well, in indeed. The pictures are in the papers.
When Leicester City won the league, he honoured his commitment to present that programme in his underwear. But we're not talking that, funnily enough, this hour. We are, in fact, doing something completely different and meeting a pioneering woman from the world of horse racing. 46 years ago, Karen Wiltshire made history when she became the first professional female jockey to win a flat race here in the UK. But Karen also suffered verbal, physical and sexual abuse as she attempted to break new ground in what was then almost an exclusively male-dominated sport. Well, I've been speaking to Karen, whose new book, No Place for a Girl, documents some of the prejudice she faced in the 1970s, and she started by telling me about the instruction she was given by one of her early trainers that if she wanted to succeed in racing, then she needed to act and dress like a boy.
He just wanted me to look just the same as the boys, so he thought it would be easier if I was out there and the owners thought that I was a boy. He wanted them to think I was good and then break it later that actually I was a girl. He'd said, don't wear makeup, cut your hair short.
And you only had your initials, Kay Wiltshire, on the board of runners. So any partial observer would, I guess, just have assumed that you were a male jockey. But how did you feel at being told to sort of hide your sex? Did you feel annoyed at the time that you were having to do that? Or did you just accept that this is what you had to do?
Well, accepted because, you know, I think with anything in a male-dominated world, you just try and fit in as best as you can. And you just do anything. You've got an apprenticeship with your trainer. I mean, he basically owns you. You can't actually get engaged or married without asking him. It was a very, very strict apprenticeship.
And what was the atmosphere in the stables like where you worked?
Well, you know, the boys thought, oh, she won't last long, and they bullied me terribly. So, I mean, there was, you know, a few nice ones that felt sorry for me. On the whole, I was badly bullied.
Well, you say in the book you were ridiculed.
Yeah, ridiculed, yeah, about my physique. And sometimes they might try and attack you in the stable. There was no CCTV there. I mean, that prepared me of when I was attacked in the changing room at Warwick. I was badly whipped during the race. And then when I dismounted, the trainer said, I'm going to walk behind you. Your jumpers are badly split. And so I didn't realise. When I got back into the changing room, which was a very, I would normally had to just change with the men, but this time they'd actually put a partition up. And so I was just relieved to have my backside stung and I was just relaxing. And then all of a sudden, a jockey that was in the race with me jumped over the partition and sexually attacked me, groping, and I was just in bra and pants. And so it was just really quite horrendous. I just screamed, but I did judo at the convent, so I knew how to fight.
Did you feel you had any recourse to report what happened to you?
No. I mean, those days you didn't do that. You know, I was supposed to have been a boy, as my trainer said, you know, so you didn't want to show up. Otherwise, if you were too much of a problem, you might not get another ride.
And then we come to the defining moment in your career, 1978, when you made history, becoming the first British female jockey to win a flat race. I wonder, did the enormity of that achievement sink in at the time? You were just 22.
I was just pleased to have a winner. That was the main thing. And the feeling of it, you just think, I just want more of winners. It was only a few lines in the Sporting Life, and it didn't actually say I was the first professional to win on the flat in the UK.
Did you feel a bit aggrieved about that?
Women in sport, they just kept quiet about them, really. But then a month later, I had the Daily Telegraph and the Mail on Sunday. They got in touch with me and wanted to do features. But my trainer, directly after the race, when I got back to the yard, and said, look, if you're going to have the press, you're not allowed to do anything, and this is in your contract. And I said, well, why? This is, you know, very odd, why can't I to help women in the future? And he said, no, they want to sexualise you. They want you in a bikini and it would look bad for racing. You've got to look professional, because I was under contract. If I didn't, then I'd be sacked.
And racing today, Karen, has changed so much when it comes to gender parity, especially. The sport is rightly lauded now as one of the few where men and women compete on an even playing field against each other. When you look at the racing world of the 1970s where you competed compared to today, I mean, it just must be unrecognisable.
Yeah, it is, but there's still far, I always thought by now there'd be about 30% girls. Really, you can only fast track it with quotas or incentives. I've thought incentives in the classics, because that's where they're getting into the group races now. But the classics, they're still not really getting much opportunity there. So if they had like 5 to 10% given to trainers and owners of added prize money, if you had a girl riding, then it might push the trainers and owners.
How likely is it that the authorities might embrace an idea like that?
I don't know. I mean, I've been pushing for things with the BHA and just hope they do. You've just got to keep pushing, really.
Thank you so much for coming in to speak to us, and good luck with the book. Karen Wilshire, thank you for speaking to us on the programme.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Well, you heard the BHA, the British Horse Racing Authority, mentioned in that interview with Karen there. In response, they told us, we agree with Karen that more needs to be done to support the careers of women working in racing. The sport is in the process of finalising a long-term workforce strategy so that we can build a more sustainable, happy and fulfilling future for everyone involved. And Karen Wiltshire's book, No Place for a Girl, is out now.
Mike, I'm staggered that you doubted our credentials to replace Gary on
not at
match
all.
Of the day. I'll be withdrawing my application forthwith. Thanks, Mike. Anyway, let's look ahead to the 9 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Young, and today on Young Again, I'm in conversation with the writer Malcolm Gladwell. I'm asking him what advice he'd give his younger self, and doing my best to get an answer. I want you to indulge me and play the game at least a little.
If I played the game, then your life would be boring and it would be too easy and you would say, oh, yeah.
You say that. Hear that conversation at 9 a.m. on Young Again on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 22 minutes to 9. Quick look at the weather. Today will be a bright and dry day for Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. England will see some patchy cloud with the chance of a few showers in the far southeast, where it will also be windy.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Faisal Islam. It's just before 20 to 9, and now a summary of the news from Caroline Nicholls.
Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he will not pressure Labour MPs to vote either in favour or against proposals to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales. The bill says two doctors in the High Court need to be satisfied that a terminally ill adult is eligible before approval is granted. Kim Leadbeater, the Labour MP bringing forward the bill, told this programme it was about shortening death rather than ending life. A victim of a barrister who sexually abused boys and young men while associated with the Church of England has joined calls for the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, to resign over his conduct in the case. Andy Morse told us Archbishop Welby's departure would be an opportunity to stand with victims. The UK is set to announce new targets to cut carbon emissions at the COP29 conference in Azerbaijan. Sir Keir Starmer has described the approach as difficult but achievable. Official figures suggest the UK's unemployment rate has risen slightly while pay growth has slowed. The rate of unemployment stood at 4.3% in the 3 months to September, up from 4% the previous quarter.
Thanks very much, Caroline. It's 21 minutes to 9. There is now unprecedented pressure on the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, to consider his position following the publication of a review into the way that the Church of England handled John Smythe, the prolific abuser of children and young men, both here and in Africa. Justin Welby has apologised for what his office, Lambeth Palace, called his own failures and omissions. He was told about the allegations surrounding Smythe when he took up his post in 2013. An independent review found what it called a distinct lack of curiosity from the Archbishop when he was informed of the allegations. Smythe could and should, said the review, have been reported to the police in 2013. Smythe died in 2018. Yes,
Yesterday, the Bishop of Newcastle became the most senior member of the clergy to call upon the Archbishop of Canterbury to stand down, calling his position untenable. Mr. Welby says he intends to stay in post. I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Cherry, Dean of Chapel at King's College, Cambridge, former Canon of Durham Cathedral. Good morning, Dr. Cherry.
Good morning, Johnny.
Do you believe the Archbishop's position is tenable?
No, I don't, actually. I think he really needs to now tender his resignation and allow there to be significant change.
What is it in particular that you think he is so responsible for that he needs to relinquish his job?
Yeah, so for my perspective on this is not a kind of forensic analysis of what he precisely did or didn't know before 2013, what he did or didn't do in 2013, or the fact that, you know, he didn't meet quickly with the victims after 2017. It's more the accumulated impact of all these things, particularly on the victims and those who identify with them. So I think what I understand his position. He has profoundly apologised. He's spoken extensively and deeply movingly about his personal regret, and he's referred to the extent to which safeguarding has become much more of a part of the culture of the Church of England. But I think that there are circumstances in which something happens whereby a person in a position of prominent leadership essentially loses the trust and the confidence and the capacity to do that really wonderful thing, which someone like an archbishop does, which sort of represent everyone at a certain moment publicly. And I think that the pain in the victim community and the history of not listening to people and not responding to people who are profoundly hurt by those in positions of power means that this is no longer a person who can carry the representative role of that office. That's my strongest thought today, particularly having listened to the testimony of various witnesses and you know, reading and so on about how they rightly feel. But I also think that there's another point as well, and that is when he spoke about possibly resigning to Cathy Newman on Channel 4 television news. Mm. He said that, you know, well, he'd considered it, but he'd spoken to senior colleagues. And I really thought to myself, well, who are these senior colleagues? Is this the Archbishop of York and the Bishop of London? Is it someone else? Who are these people? And why do they have such a powerful voice in this? And the victims and others simply do not. So it's a question of this unaccountable sort of slight, murky mass of seniority, which is not the Archbishop. It's something else which is kind of keeping him there. And I, in a way, when I'm speaking, I'm sort of speaking to people in that group as well, saying, come on, you know, really think about what it is to be Archbishop and how this has really tarnished the image of the role.
His allies say that removing him would be scapegoating and would ignore the improvements in safeguarding that have happened in his time in office.
Yeah, so I'm not calling about removing him. I'm talking about him stepping down.
Well, and I think that's pretty much the same sort of thing, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's the same consequence, but for different reasons. And, you know, I think that if he steps down, even if it's on advice of close colleagues, he is acting within his volition and dignity. And so there's a difference between, you know, what actually in leadership, there's a difference between what works practically and what is actually, you know, technically impossible. It is not technically impossible. He doesn't need to be dismissed for what has happened, but there can be a whole narrative and a celebration of what he's done positively if he takes that step. If he doesn't, this process of people saying that, you know, they cannot bear the thought of someone with this record on this issue in that position will only increase and get worse. So I understand the point you're making, but I do think it is actually a significant difference.
Dr. Stephen Cherry, Dean of Chapel, King's College, Cambridge, thank you very much for joining us.
The UK is to set a new target of cutting carbon emissions by 81% by 2035 from their 1990 levels as part of the Prime Minister's announcements as he arrived last night at the COP29 climate summit in Azerbaijan. The country has an opportunity to lead the world in the industries of the future by making Britain a clean energy superpower, he says. There will be extra subsidies for wind power. The government has already lifted restrictions on onshore wind. There's a £1 billion boost to domestic manufacturing of turbine blades in Hull, as we were hearing earlier. And we're now joined by Ed Miliband, the Energy Security and Net Zero Secretary from the talks in Baku. Good morning, Mr. Miliband. Good afternoon, perhaps, where you are.
Yeah, good morning or afternoon, Faisal.
Let's look at what this means for the UK and how the world's changing, but perhaps not in your direction. Can you be clear what the 81% reduction means to listeners?
It is about driving forward with the changes that we're already making to make Britain a clean energy superpower, which will have massive benefits for us in terms of energy security, lower bills, good jobs, like the announcement today by Scottish Power investing in blade manufacturer in Siemens, and tackling the climate crisis. And this is all about our national self-interest, whether it is about what we are doing at home, what we are doing here at these talks to work with other countries to tackle the climate crisis. It is both in our economic self-interest, our energy security self-interest, and indeed in our long-term interest in protecting future generations from climate breakdown.
Now, this is not your first rodeo at COP, is it? I recall reporting on you at COP15 all those years ago in Copenhagen. But you just hear some of the same things. And I'm just wondering, you know, it's almost like this argument is couched in terms of quite complicated numbers and reductions and negotiations with incorrigible acronyms. But when it comes down to it, it means people replacing their boilers with heat pumps. It means driving an electric vehicle, even if you don't like them. That's what it means over the next 10, 15 years.
But, you know, I see it slightly differently. I agree about the incorrigible acronyms, but I'm in the better lives business. And this is about better lives for people today, as well as about protecting future generations tomorrow. And just to sort of let's go through them. You know, our warm homes plan is about insulating homes and about cutting carbon emissions. Our Clean Power 2030 plan is about doing the right thing on climate, but it's about getting the energy security we have sorely lacked, and about creating the good jobs of the future that are going to drive that transition. Investing in carbon capture and storage so industry can decarbonize. That is about good jobs. It's also about lower emissions. You see, I think what's changed, as you say, this is not my first rodeo, but what's changed so much is the economics has moved in the direction of the ethics, if you like. So the two come together. That's why I think this transition is unstoppable. The question is, how quickly can we do it? And I think there is massive first mover advantage for a country like Britain.
Okay, that's the sort of strategic top-down case, but you've got to carry the population with you, including in some tougher changes. You know, this is always described in terms of the sort of low-hanging fruit, the stuff that's done in the plumbing, if such a thing exists, of the energy system, the things that people don't have to change their consumer behaviour for example. You have a majority of 174. You could make the brave and tougher decisions right now, but you're not. I put that to you. Are you scared of five Reform MPs and a few dinosaur union bosses?
No, I mean, I don't know what your example you're thinking of, but I suppose the way I think about this is we carry people with us because people want us to take climate action, if we show this can help reduce the costs people face, if we show that it can clean up our air and do the right things. And that's what we are about doing. And look, I don't think anyone would accuse us of not being bold, you know, whether it's clean power by 2030 or our warm homes plan or our investment in carbon capture and storage
Let me come in here on wind power, for example. We have this situation, and I know there's a technical reason in the market, complicated market for electricity, why this happens, but you're paying hundreds of millions of pounds for these beautiful wind turbines, as I'm sure you see them, to switch off. And that's going to head to billions of pounds a year.
That just seems farcical. Well, we've got to change that. And let's go to the tough decisions. You know, I think the Prime Minister was the first party leader in history to use the word pylons in a party conference speech, and in a positive way. We are saying we've got to build this clean energy infrastructure of the future. You know, every solar panel we don't put up, every wind turbine we don't put up, every piece of grid we don't build makes us more energy insecure and raises bills. So, you know, we are willing to have a conversation with the country, Faisal, to say we are going to need to build this grid. We want communities that host that clean energy infrastructure to benefit from it. So absolutely, and that, the reason I mention that, that is the way to reduce the cost of what they call curtailment, because the reason that wind power is not being used is we don't have the grid infrastructure to be able to accommodate it. So look, this is a government willing to do the right things, determined to do the right things for all of the reasons that I've set out, like energy security, jobs and climate indeed.
And when do bills come down then? Are you not creating a bit of a hostage to fortune? You don't control energy markets, you don't control some of the other factors here around trade.
Well, you're absolutely right to say that we're moving from fossil fuel prices, which we don't control, to homegrown clean energy, which we do have control over. I go by what the National Energy System Operator said last week. Very significant report, independent National Energy System Operator said our clean power target, which some people thought was totally unachievable, it's achievable and it will lead to cheaper electricity. That is such a sort of fundamental stake in the ground about the direction we're going in. Why? Because we've seen this transformation in the cost of renewables over the last 15 years. When I was doing this job previously, it was more expensive. Now it is cheaper than fossil fuels.
But hang on, what's driving that is Chinese production of these technologies, solar panels and wind turbines too. Obviously, a big announcement about UK manufacturing. But from what I hear from the energy companies, they're waiting to import much cheaper Chinese wind turbines. Are you going to encourage that in order to get to net zero?
We've got to diversify the supply chain. Look, I don't think we want dominance by any country, including
but some
China.
Help, perhaps.
And the truth is, well, but look, in a way, that's why the announcement we're making today, that's why GB Energy, Great British Energy, that's why our National Wealth Fund are so important, because we are saying not only are we having the energy policy to drive towards clean power, but we're having the industrial policy to make sure we make it in the UK. And that is the way you diversify the supply chain.
I get that. And that sounds like a win-win, and it's the win-win everybody wants. You get the jobs, you get the cheap energy, you get the energy security. But when push comes to shove, these wind turbines are available now. These electric vehicles are available now. And if the main factor here was to cut emissions, you'd be encouraging the Chinese in, would you not? You'd be trying to get them to set up their car factories in the UK. Is that what this government is doing?
But look, my principles here are accelerate the transition and diversify and do both together. And that's what we've got to do. You know, we do want inward investment into the UK, but we also
want to make
sure...
From the Chinese.
That's obviously something we'll look at, but we've got to make sure we protect our national security. That is absolutely paramount. We've also got to diversify the supply chains. But you've got to do both things together. We can't leave the British people exposed as they are to fossil fuel, the roller coaster of fossil fuel prices. We've also got to build up our own industry, and we can do both things together.
The reason why I press this, and you obviously know this, you're a big Atlanticist, you even know the rules of baseball, right? But you know what's happened in America. You know that you were in America, and you've seen that Bidenomics, and I suspect you think that it succeeded economically, but has utterly failed politically. So... does that not check your own ambitions in this regard? What's happened?
Look, I'll let other people interpret the US election, but I offer this one observation, which is inflation and the cost of living was clearly a massive issue over the last 4 years. What is our whole agenda about? It is getting off the roller coaster of fossil fuel prices. Why did we have the cost of living crisis following Putin's invasion of Ukraine? We had it because we were exposed. Whether it's North Sea gas or imported gas, prices shot up. What this offers, what this agenda offers for a country like Britain is the energy security that we sorely lack at the moment. So I think we're drawing the right lessons. And we're also drawing the lessons that, you know, the British people deserve the good jobs they've been crying out for a long time. And we're going to make it happen as part of our mission.
Ed Miliband, thanks for joining us from COP29 in Baku.
Faisal, how did you know Ed Miliband knows the rules of baseball?
I don't know. I don't even want to acknowledge. No, an old interview.
An old interview. Well, you've done very well with that one. It's 6 minutes to nine. And we're going to be looking at what's coming up here on Radio 4. There's a choice of listening after the Today programme. Here on Radio 4, it is Young Again. And you can continue listening to more live news coverage and stories whenever you want with the live news stream on BBC Sounds. It is a superb service. Just go to the live dial at the top of the BBC Sounds homepage and tap on Live News. All of our news podcasts are also on BBC Sounds, including the rather brilliant Today podcast and Americast, of course, with Justin Webb. Or if you'd like to
have something completely different. There is a new music stream called Radio 3 Unwind. To listen, just go to BBC Sounds, tap on Radio 3 Unwind, or should you have the great fortune to own a smart speaker, you can say, play Radio 3 Unwind. And when, if you do stick with Radio 4, it is Malcolm Gladwell, the writer and podcaster who is on Young Again with Kirsty Young, and that's coming up this morning after the 9 o'clock news. As magic tricks goes, the last one to come out of the magic circle, the secretive club where magicians gather and swap tales, if not tricks, is pretty breathtaking. A masquerade followed by a disappearance. It is a heck of a story. Here to take us through it is Laura London, the first female chair of the magic circle. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Johnny. Hi.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for joining us. Can you just take me through this strange tale of Raymond Lloyd, sometime member of the magic circle?
Of course. Well, this is a very, very brave woman called Sophie Lloyd managed to fool the most prestigious magic society in the world, the Magic Circle, by posing as that male you were just talking about, male magician Raymond Lloyd. However, when women were finally allowed into the society in 1991, she finally revealed her true identity, only to be expelled for deliberate deception, which I just think is the most brilliant thing to be expelled for at the Magic Circle. However, things, of course, have changed since then. We are an inclusive and diverse club. So now we would just love to track Sophie down and hopefully invite her back if she's willing.
It is an extraordinary story. I mean, especially that immediate expulsion at the moment that women are allowed into the society. But Sophie Lloyd didn't actually act alone, did she? Because there was another female magician that wanted into the club.
Well, absolutely. It's actually a tale of two people, of course. A woman called Jenny Wynn Stanley, who was the actual magician. In the 1980s, she was sort of doing magic around Great Yarmouth, a very competent one, clearly, because she taught Raymond. Raymond was actually an actress, or Sophie Lloyd was an actress, not a magician. Yeah. And around 1989, they sort of put their heads together, and I'm guessing Jenny perhaps couldn't quite pull off a male or this male deception. Mm. So enlisted her friend, who was clearly very good at what she did. They spent a couple of years working on not only the magic, but also her ability to convince people that she was a man, which in itself is a huge task. And then braved it, went into the magic, so became an associate. So in 1990, became a full member in 1991, just sort of several months before they allowed women in. And I'm sure that when she revealed her true identity, they thought that the society would find it highly amusing and go, well, well done, and, you know, and stay. But that just wasn't the case, and they didn't find it funny at all,
sadly. But now they have changed their mind, and it's sort of, come back, Sophie, we'd love to have you back in the club, but they can't find her.
She seems to be missing. I mean, of course, we don't know what's happened to her since about 1997. There was an article where she was using magic to do such great things. She was educating young people in schools about bullying and using magic to do that. So we know she continued doing it. And that in itself, just to use magic in such a positive way, is another reason why it's such a shame that she wasn't able to stay in the society. But after that, it's sort of the trail goes cold. We don't know where she is. We've been trying to track her down. Unfortunately, Jenny is no longer with us, but hopefully Sophie is.
If you did run into her, what would you say?
Well, probably sorry.
And come back.
Yes, absolutely. Come back. You know, I mean, we would love to find out what she's doing. The fact that she continued to do magic, we'd love to know her story. And more than that, I think the thing is, she was so brave, and at a time where women were, you know, before women were burning bras outside of the building, it was quite clear that women desperately in our industry wanted to be a member of the society, and she did it. And I'd like to thank her as well. You know, thank you for doing that. And of course, nobody knew it at the time, and it sort of seemed to get washed under the carpet. But now we